was no way.
Science man, all them silly wires. The planet don't want none of that. It takes you if you're fit to go.
Takes you.
Fit?
Your woman and your kids, were they fit to go? Or did you spoil them?
He'd spoil them.
Too much think and talk. That'd spoil them.
Got to know it all.
Know it.
If you'd done that, Daddy Science Man, if they're no good, they just get spilled away.
Spilled?
You see the sky, all sick. What that is spillings. All them, now they're fit to go. I picked them. I picked you. I walk you and guard you and guide you till it comes for us.
It comes for us.
The lightning.
The lightning comes to take us. Can he come too?
You a Jew?
Yes.
Okay. It's a start. It's believing. But you don't do it right. You got too much sin.
Sin?
All this is sin. Your sin is to know things. Now, you want to come with us? You've got to get it all out of your brain.
Get it out.
All the muck you learned, every bit.
But you can't unlearn.
All them words in there.
You've got to get them out.
Get them out.
Words.
That's it.
How?
How?
Listen to him.
What's that?
I won't.
Say!
Hey, you!
I want to stay with him!
This is Bristol. It's Friday. It's, now just about 18 minutes past five. Sorry, we're a little bit late. And welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 28th of June 2024, streaming live from the Coomber Community Centre in Bristol, which is under threat of eviction by Bristol City Council right now. So we feel like almost like shoulder to shoulder with not the squatters, the occupiers. No, the rightful owners, the rightful occupants who the council are bullying. The old Temple of Port, that is, Bristol, in the empire of lies. Really, most of those lies, of course, foisted on us by the mainstream press, who are having an absolute field day during this general election. But we're live on the talkradio.org.uk stream at radioqUK.com in Camberley, Surrey, DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton in Warwickshire, and also now too on radiosoapbox.com in Worthing, East Sussex, but live as well on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from all good app stores. Please use Aurora, download that, and cancel your Google Play. I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its military propaganda psyops, boring us to tears with irrelevant distractions, puff pieces on the conspirators, and hatchet jobs on the heroes. Helping us navigate the World Economic Forum's fourth industrial revolution, or the fourth Reich matrix, whatever you want to call it. It's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and former Green Party councillor for Ashley Ward, Jude English, sitting in with us here too. In part one, we'll be looking at how this show got cancelled again, this time from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft. Also, Bristol's new chief executive. We were planning to have Joe Banks come in and talk, but we're just not going to have time for that now, I'm afraid. We'll be looking at that in the next couple of weeks. But what we will be doing is revisiting George Orwell's birthday this week. I went down to Sutton Courtenay, where he's buried. The reason why is because that was the residence of the editor of The Observer at the time, who he was writing for. And that was a fascinating discussion about surveillance and tech with journalists and techies. Also, elections in the UK, France, America and Iran. In the UK here, will Labour take us into the EU army and intelligence? arrangements. In part two, Julian Assange is freed in a plea bargain deal with the US government. Everyone getting rather excited and rather positive about that. Nice to see at last. But I asked the question to the current WikiLeaks editor, Christian Hranafsson. What is WikiLeaks actually doing now? And as he explains, actually quite a lot of their time has been taken up, as I'm sure the Pentagon wanted, with fighting for Julian's release. Also, the great Glastonbury Festival swindle from LA, and from LA, Naomi Wolf revisits the Old Testament and in relation to what's going on in Gaza. Well, I shouldn't say that. I'll just call it a genocide. I don't know why they can't do that on the mainstream press. Anyway, Iranian and Russian news censored in the UK by the telecoms cartel and Ofcom. Us cancelled off Bristol Community FM by the Bristol Mafia. And now from PRSC2 by the trans lobby. But before we talk about our cancellation, I'm pleased to welcome Jude English, who's a former Green councillor here in Ashley Ward, right in the ward itself. Hi, Jude.
Oh, hi. Hi, Tony.
So could you just tell us a little bit about what you first got you into politics and why the Green Party and when? Three questions in one.
Well, I've been thinking about this recently because it's funny when you get cancelled yourself from your own party. So 2006, I'd just finished a degree in environmental architecture and renewables and stuff like that, and I was thinking about the future, I think, and Caroline Lucas became the leader of the Green Party. And I thought that was interesting because prior to that, they'd been leaderless. They'd been this kind of, you know, collective...
They have these joint leaders, don't they, or something?
Well, now they do, but at that point, there'd been no leaders. There'd just been spokespeople, principal spokespeople, and these were the top dogs, the show ponies of the very small and, you know, rather fringe Green Party. And so she became leader, and I thought, that's good, a woman as leader. And, you know, obviously she'd been quite popular and well thought of. And the Stern Report came out. I don't know whether any of you remember that, but it was a big and very important report by, I think he's Lord Stern now, and it talked about the cost to the whole world, but particularly Britain, of not dealing with the climate issue. And it was a very, very influential document amongst people who were interested in that sort of stuff. So I was moved to join a political party. I'd never been a member of a political party before. So I stepped into that place and thought, there's my home, because I'm a deep ecologist and, you know, interested in politics.
When do you deep ecology? What's that?
Well, the other thing that had happened to me at the time, I suppose, is that I'd been doing some other interesting work around transition, that not transition as we would think about it today, but transition, peak oil and the transition to the new world order. Well, how is the world really going to change from the modern industrial farmer state, you know, all the things that you talk about, and into this different world where we don't kind of kill the planet.
Can I try and simplify that? Because the way I think of it is just some sort of post-industrial...
Yeah, yeah.
You know, deindustrialisation.
Yeah, degrowth, deindustrialisation.
So the industry in this country seems now to consist mostly of office blocks with people phoning people up to bother them for things that they don't want, and not so much actually building anything anymore.
Yeah. So there were these things going on. I'd attended a really interesting course at Schumacher College. Schumacher, the economist, not the racing driver. And Rob Hopkins, who's founded the transition movement, had been there, very influential guy to me at the time. And there was quite a few people from BP. It was a really fascinating, an interesting diversity of opinions. And so I was moved to join the Green Party. I have to say, for the first few years, I didn't really do much, like most people in the Green Party, just gave them some money and let them get on with it.
Okay, so you stood as a councillor. Did you get asked to stand? Did you ask to stand?
Well, I'd been quite... I think that was 2015. I'd been getting a bit more involved, and I offered to stand in Lawrence Hill. Obviously, that was somewhere we had no chance in hell of getting anywhere.
Well, I myself was a paper candidate in Clifton.
Yes.
This would be around about 2004, 2005, something like that. Did quite well. Mm. They were all saying, oh, they were surprised. I'm sure it was because it was me, not because it was the Green Party, no. But, so Lawrence Hill.
Yeah, Lawrence Hill, because, Well, I suppose I must have been late to the game, actually. And I know what it was. I couldn't stand in Ashley because they already had people there.
Okay.
So I must have said, oh, well, I'll stand in Lawrence Hill and I'll have a go. So I stood in 2015, didn't get anywhere, but did increase the vote and worked jolly hard, actually. And then the next year, I think Rob Breyer decided not to stand in Ashley and I put myself forward.
It's an interesting ward, isn't it? Most people know it as St Paul's.
Well,
it's a bit wider than that.
Oh, it's much wider than that. I mean, it's actually, I think, a little microcosm of the whole of Bristol, really. You've got St Andrews, the kind of posh bit at the top. You've got St Paul's. You've got Montpellier, which is, I don't know, used to be students and a little bit radical. I think we'd perhaps argue it's changed a bit over the last 10 years. St Paul's, St Agnes, St Werburgh's, of course. I mean, you know, so it's an interesting mix.
Can you sum up your experience of being a councillor at the City Council? This is during the time where we had a mayor, isn't it?
Yeah, so
the idea is the mayor kind of takes away a lot of the influence from the old councillors. We've now gone back to the councillor system.
Yeah,
did you feel that you kind of turned up on to do a job which was almost redundant as a councillor under a mayor?
Yeah, I think I did, actually. The first 4 years with Marvin were interesting. It was a much smaller Green councillor group, if you remember. It was about 11. We'd gone down, we'd lost a few. It was a kind of tight group. I'd say most people were ecological Greens, you know, interested in climate and the Stern Report and things like that. Not so much the social justice warrior type Green that we seem to be having a lot of these days. So the first 4 years, I mean, Marvin was a tough leader. He was very, very authoritarian. Greens didn't really get a chance. You know, the Green Party leader at the time was sometimes to be found crying. He made people cry. He was quite... He was difficult. He was a bit authoritarian. And we didn't really have any power.
What Marvin's kind of famous for is when you ask a question, turning it, kind of throwing it back at you and saying, you know, basically not answering the question, but getting you to justify how you dare to ask such a question. That sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two things looking back on it. People have got to remember, I think, that the Greens have moved to the place they're in now, 35, possibly 36 after this election, councillors, in a relatively short amount of time. So in 2016, we were 11. So a small group of 11, we weren't even the second party. So we were just doing that thing where you can say, oh, we'll have a motion on this. We wish everything was green. You know, vote on that. La di da. So, and it was more interesting in a way. I was the chair of place scrutiny. So that was the time of the arena. There was all the stuff over that going on. There was a lot of the stuff about the building and the university. So Marvin was controlling the whole agenda. We had a shared rainbow cabinet at the very beginning with a Tory and a Green. He got rid of that really quickly because he decided that he had to have complete control and power. So the first 4 years were quite interesting. I think Greens were just kind of doing what Greens probably do over most of the country, is like, you know, make a fuss about trees, make a fuss about this, whatever, not actually do any governing or any leading or any making decisions. So we weren't making any decisions at all. And then the second 4 years, obviously we had COVID, which is a real downer. And what happened there, I think, in terms of the council was very interesting. You know, the whole of the council, the first 4 years, was very buzzing and full of people, but a lot of presence, you know. If you wanted to talk to a planning officer, you could go down the corridor and have a word with them.
Yeah.
By the time we'd had COVID and everybody's been working from home, and even now I think if you go to City Hall, a real culture of absence. So people are working remotely. There isn't that feeling of collegiateness. There isn't the kind of sense of working as a team, and I think that's been a problem for lots of workplaces, but I think certainly it was down at council.
It's actually really depressing to hear all this, because I'm someone who worked in newsrooms in the 1990s, busy newsrooms, and I go into a newsroom today, even up at the BBC, it's quiet. You know, everyone's sort of focused in their little workstation on their own thing, and I rather like to be, you know, workplaces where people are maybe calling across to each other, that there's a sense of a bit of a buzz going on, everyone's kind of pulling together. You've got to say something, I think, about the arena, because this whole business has been such a sort of plague in Bristol. We were first of all told that this massive piece of land next to Temple Mead Station, that's where it was going to be. It was like pulling teeth to get everyone to agree to do it there, which George Ferguson managed to do. And then, whilst Marvin has appeared, we suddenly hear, oh, no, it's not going to happen there. That land is going to the university. Now, the university is just intending to build its own buildings for lectures and things like that on there, but also accommodation. The university seems to run the city now. It's almost like the student money coming in from the student grants, loans, is the only thing that the city's economy can really, really rely on. Lots of developments happening because of it. But anyway, the arena, a whole arena idea, it hasn't even been started yet, is up at the old Filton Airfield, which is way, way out of town, off the transport hubs. And this just seems to be, it's one of those decisions which is really about the university and about money, much more than it is about where should we have an arena if we need one, which lots and lots of the public will go to. Hardly anyone's going to go to the university site there.
Well, yeah, looking back on it, I mean, at the time, this is, goes back to what you were asking me at the beginning about whether the Greens had any real power. I mean, Labour had complete and utter power over the whole of that process, but the mayor particularly, I mean, I think even the Labour backbenchers were finding it really difficult, because you had your elite bunch of, say, eight cabinet people all being paid, you know, over 30, 40,
that's right, they get paid
grand.
Extra, don't they?
Get paid
extra. Which
makes
it a little bit tainted. It's like, well, if you agree with the mayor, he'll put you in the cabinet and you get paid more money.
Well, I mean, that is what happened, actually, isn't it, if you think about it. He had a couple, a Green and a Tory that he sat very quickly, and then very quickly got a new cabinet, Labour cabinet, and then the ones who weren't yes men, like Mark, the guy who was the transport guy,
Mark Bradshaw. Yeah.
You know, if you didn't say yes, you were sacked, and then a new young thing would be put into the place. So it was definitely a feeling of that, but also the cabinet basically controlled it. So the cabinet of these eight people were making the decisions, and Marvin was making the decisions, and behind the scenes, Kevin Slocum was also making the decisions.
Oh, yes.
So
yes,
I think what you'd say,
the PR guy,
is that you look like you've got democracy with those 70 councillors, but really you've got eight chosen Labour people with Marvin at the top making all the decisions. And that's really how it was. If you remember, we had a motion to council to have the arena in the centre. All 70 backbench councillors, I think, voted for that, and Marvin overrode it. And that was the problem with the mayoral system. Or you could argue, if you were him, probably, that was the advantage of the mayoral system, that we actually got a decision. I have to say, looking back on those 8 years and being quite critical of Marvin a little bit, you know, the beginning about the authoritarianism and all the rest of it, I can see now that it was actually a very difficult job to control that, to make decisions. And some of the stuff he would say to the Greens about, you know, you don't have to make decisions, you're not in power. When you are in power, let's see how you do. I think it's going to be interesting to see the next four years what that looks like.
You know, so you've been part of the kind of rise of the Green Party in Bristol here. Now we've had, back in May, we had local elections. The Greens are now the biggest party on the City Council. In fact, I think they were just before as well. But they, but you're not part of it. Why
no,
not?
No.
Why not?
Well, I was cancelled. I was cancelled, Tony. Interestingly, the parallel with what I've just talked about with the Labour Party, in the Greens, you get that look of it being a bit fluffy and nice and whatever, but there's a controlling group in the Green Party, the Regional Committee, which has probably only got about eight people on it because they've bullied most of the other people off it, and they have the ultimate controlling sanction of suspension. So all it took was for one colleague of mine to write a complaint to say that basically he doesn't like my views on sex-based rights, and that, I'll tell you what, it's quite interesting, the complaint says that my views are so disreputable that I was a danger to Carla's campaign. I think most people would know that if you saw me around St. Paul's or being a councillor, you wouldn't probably have a chat with me about the sex gender issue, because it's not something that came up on the doorstep, not something that I made a big fuss about. But this was one guy who'd bullied me before, put in a complaint, his mate said, that's it, she's suspended, which actually means expelled in this context, and that's it. because there's no control and no discipline. So it was actually also, I think, you know, well, it was deliberate. It was deliberate. It was sabotage. It said Jude must not be allowed to be a member of the new administration. Must be not allowed to be a counsellor. It must be a punishment. She must be made an example of. I mean, that's actually what it said in the complaint. Now, of course, it's shocking. It's really shocking, actually, because the Greens had already last year just lost a court case about discrimination. So you'd think they might have learnt something a little bit about what they'd done
so
wrong.
Did you not think did you think about taking them to court over that decision?
I indeed will be taking them to court, Tony.
Okay.
So one of the reasons it's good that I'm here today is that yesterday, in fact, so I suspended just a few days before the nominations were due in. It was deliberate. It said she mustn't be allowed to be a councillor. So it's a definite, because of her views, she mustn't be allowed to be a councillor. Not that I'd said anything nasty to anybody or done anything, you know, hit anybody.
Can you tell us what your views, so-called controversial view, is that will bring the Green Party into dispute? Are you allowed to repeat it?
I think I am, because actually it's quite interesting, isn't it? So my so-called controversial view is the view of most people in this country, is that sex is a real thing, immutable, that's unchanging, and that women have the right to freedom of association, freedom of speech, and that we can have same-sex spaces when appropriate. So those are not really radical views. In fact, everything I would say is already the law, yeah? And it's related possibly to the fact that I'm a lesbian. You know, this is the other thing. I think it was a homophobic attack. The guy who sent in the complaint, I mean, I do know who it was. It was anonymous, but it's very obvious who it was, had already previously bullied me and called me a Nazi, called me all sorts of names, and said, Tony, that I'm part of a group that believes in conspiracy theories.
Martin, can I just bring you in? See if you can talk. Let's see.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah,
I can hear me.
That sounds good. This sounds a bit similar to the things that have been going on in the Labour Party, doesn't it? With Jeremy Corbyn, with people, I mean, not just Corbyn, obviously, but various people in the Labour Party being told that they're anti-Semitic.
Well, it is. I mean, in a way, this is politics. I mean, this is what it's all about. The people use these mechanisms as a means of, you know, the Greens are not going to be, what's the word? They're not going to be different from any other group that's formed. The Labour Party has been full of factionalism in all my lifetime. There's been continuous battles. I mean, if you don't like rowing with people, you shouldn't be in it, really. I mean, that's what goes on. But I think it is significant that the trans lobby has got such power, because obviously Stella Perrett, who we're going to talk about later, I mean, she was removed from the Morning Star, having been a cartoonist there for many, many years, for putting what was regarded as an anti-trans cartoon. And I think there's another element that strikes me about this is, if we're going to debate these things, people have got to allow people to have different opinions. Mm. I mean, I don't necessarily agree with those people, but I'm perfectly prepared to listen to what they've got to say. But you can't shut me up at the same time. That's not reasonable, is it?
Well, this is the interesting thing, isn't it? And if I'm going to critically reflect, as I will, I had been writing to the chief executive officer of the Green Party for over 18 months, saying, actually, in February 2023, I wrote a letter saying, I've been elected to be on the Green Party Women Commission committee, so that's a committee that's to do with women's rights, but I suspect that I will be maliciously complained about at some point in the future. So I'd like you to note my protected beliefs, and I'd like you to make sure that if I'm maliciously complained about, that you investigate properly and that you do something about it. So I'd already set this in February 2023, and then I wrote over 10,000 words of whistleblow to the same CEO, saying a number of different things when different people have been attacked, when Alison Teal was suspended in Sheffield. So I've got a catalogue of all the things that have happened, not to me, to other people. So actually, part of the court case will be that I've been attacked and suspended and expelled for its victimisation. But the thing that I think is interesting, Martin, that you're saying is the Green Party is It's kind of a toy political party, I'm going to say. It's a bit like role play. They're all playing at being politicians. I agree with you that if you don't go into politics, if you don't want to be part of the rough and tumble of it, but what they don't seem to understand is that there is such a thing as factionalism in politics. And I think what you had in the Greens before, and I'd say even in 2016 when I was part of a nice, you know, green group, was a lot of people who agreed fundamentally that the planet's in dire danger, we need to do something about it, and what we're trying to do is to get political leverage to do that. But what we've now got is a faction, very strong faction, a kind of queer social justice faction that has completely taken over the party. But what's and the party doesn't know how to deal with it because it's not got that long history of Labour of dealing with factions, having different sections, understanding that that's how it works. I just don't think it's there. That's partly what it's battling with at the moment. And what we're going to see, if I'm going to reflect forward about what's happening to the Green Party, a big influx of new members, not all of whom will have their a view of all the Green Party policies, because some of the Green Party policies are absolutely nutty. You know, they really, really are. You know, they were put through when people weren't looking. And
give it an example or two.
Top of my head. Well, some of the ones on trans rights, actually, were put in 2015, and I think now if we look back and had another look, people would say that's perhaps not what we'll be put in now. You know,
Isn't it funny? So a lot of these policies seem to have been brought in before people realised what the implications are.
Yeah, I mean, I'll touch on some of the other ones. Yeah. The stuff to do with sex work is work, to do with prostitution. As a feminist and a supporter of women's rights, there's a lot of those... That side of things, which I disagree with. I mean, and I've disagreed with for all the 16 years I've been in the party, but it's never been a problem because it's never been something that people really talk about. There's lots of stuff to do with consent, lots of that very, very progressive, very, very woke stuff that's in there. That's one of the reasons the Green Party is, at the moment, shut down its website, so you can't see the policies.
Right. Yeah, they took everything off, didn't they?
Well,
yeah.
they've made it, and that's because there was one on maternity, wasn't there, came up in the press last week, where basically it was some kind of we think natural childbirth should be the only way forward.
Well, there was one about rationing meat and rationing dairy produce.
There's another one actually about you shouldn't have pets. It's funny because there's all these pictures of Zach Polanski and Carla and pets and dogs and all, isn't it lovely?
What a car crash. Obviously not a proper debate happening in this party.
No.
You're not having a proper party conference where these things are properly thrashed out.
No, and that's the issue, and that's one of the things that I've been talking to the CEO about, saying, you know, you can't... So they've tried to shut the Green Women's Group down from the very beginning. They just don't want women to speak. I mean, much more than in the Labour Party. At least in the Labour Party, you've got the Labour Women's Declaration, you've got Lesbian Labour. They're allowed to speak. The Labour Party's not stupid enough to expel them because you're expelling somebody for their protected belief. I think the Labour Party gets it. The Green Party doesn't get it at all. You know, no debate is the authoritarian issue in the Green Party. But what I was going to say about the factions is we've got loads of new members coming in, including a lot of Muslim members. So the Gaza thing has really, really made an explosion in Muslim members. Yeah. We've got a new Muslim special interest group that's just started. Yeah. Now, there will be clashes within factionalism coming up very, very fast inside the party because we haven't got this issue of free speech sorted out. You know, there will be Muslim men like the guy who took my place here in Ashley, Abdul Malik, who's a leader in the local mosque, who I'm pretty sure if you pressed him to say, you know, can a man ever be a woman? Will you allow a trans woman into the male side, the female side of your mosque, is going to say, that's not going to be happening. Yeah. But he won't be attacked because he's a man and he's a Muslim. Although, let's see, it's going to be an interesting thing, isn't it? As I said, Shara Ali, the person who's just won the discrimination case against the Green Party, is, of course, a man and a Muslim.
Well, you asked, just before we came on air, we were waiting for Windows to do its updates. I was so sorry, everybody, about that. We were talking about this idea of intellectual rigour in the party. And I remember, I can't remember the lady's name, but she was a physicist. She was the leader of the Green Group on Bristol City Council.
Oh, Eleanor. Yeah.
Chatting with her about 5G. I thought was going to be an interesting conversation about the idea that mobile data was the policy, this is going to go forward into the future as the main way data was going to... And the differences between a policy around using things like fibre to get data around, which uses virtually no energy, where 5G, where now, for example, in Ireland, they haven't actually got enough power to power all their data centres and their mobile networks. This is a massive issue to do with energy, and I would have thought this would be something that the Greens would be interested in. And I remember putting the question to her, and I just got a completely blank response, like, well, it's not an issue. But to me, this is the sort of thing that, you know, the Greens should be looking at. If you want to reduce energy, then you should be questioning this policy to do with the internet. Well, do we want it all going through the airwaves, which takes 100 or more times more energy, or do we want it going in these little lines through the ground? So that's the sort of thing that I was quite frustrated with back then. But, I mean, you're saying that this is a wider problem in the party?
Well, I think it's a very big problem. I think when the Greens took a turn a few years ago to go, oh, we're going to get involved in social justice and have all these other policies, so we look like all the other, you know.
Well, social justice is a basically good thing, isn't it? Yeah, about redistribution of wealth and things like that.
Yeah, it's a good thing. But I think what I would say, yes, lack of intellectual rigour. Let's take one of the reasons why I was cancelled and expelled. So I wrote something for a website called A Lesbian Perspective, and I talked about my deep ecology roots and how I'm interested in... I'm an energy scientist, actually, so let's go back to that. And I said there's some rather strange views in the Green Party, including people who don't believe in evolution. So, you know, if you don't know a man and a woman and how dimorphic sex happens, you don't believe in evolution. And I was a bit scathing about that. But I talked about the big pharma issue, how we don't seem to be understanding the connection between giving the green light to big pharma to, you know, use puberty blockers and all sorts of medical intervention on young people, and the association with the massive, massive money industries. But also, I didn't say it in the article, but the only thing that people think about when they think about radical new policies for the Green Party is universal basic income. I think they're always trotting that one out. Now, that's an old-fashioned thing now. All the other parties have got hold of it. What's the radical new view that the Greens have got on anything? And I think you're right. The energy issue, things like 5G, data storage, data management and all the rest of it, we're not talking about any of that. We're not looking at anything future-proofing. There's nothing... If you said to me, who's the leading green thinker on this sort of stuff in the party, I think you'd really struggle, you know. Well, it might be me, but they'd kick me out. But so, you know, there's nobody looking into these things. There's nobody getting ahead of Labour. It's just repeating the same old stuff.
Martin, isn't it just a simple thing that as the Green Party, people like Jude have put the legwork in to make it a credible force, certainly here in Bristol politics, as they get closer to power, so the lobbies move in and they say, we don't want people like this around?
Well, it's partly to do with the lobbies. It's also just, you know, being in power. I mean, the Labour Party had a similar history 100 years ago.
But there's an element of control freakery here, isn't there? Yeah. We have decided what the direction of the party's going to be, and here's someone that's not singing from the same hymn sheet. Let's get rid of them.
Well, I think there's obviously what the Labour Party was never a Marxist party, but if you've got a theory like Marxist theory, people have, you know, the sort of left-wing politics I was involved in, you're expected to read these documents and understand what's in it.
Well, isn't the similar thing for the Greens, the kind of ecology report you were talking about?
You know, this can't just make it up.
This is where
I think I'm struggling with them, and possibly was even before I was cancelled, is that there is no intellectual rigour, there is no looking at any of that, there is no educational aspect to why people join the Green Party. And what you've got now is people joining the Green Party from all four different directions. You've got people joining from the Conservatives, joining from Labour, joining from Liberal, and joining from nowhere. Do you know what I mean? So they're going to have to face this really difficult balancing act, which they're also having to do at the moment, where they're fighting here against a Labour candidate and in Waverley against a Tory, where, you know, you've got to be actually quite a centrist party.
Yeah.
Although they're not. They're a very, like, Marxist, left-wing...
You've got to be a little offshoot of the Uniparty. That's the idea, I suppose.
So I think that it's gonna trip them up in a few years because there's no intellectual core. And again,
isn't that part of the deal? You know, the idea is you vote for something, but you don't have to actually think about it.
Well, I think that is what's happening. And look what's happening with this campaign in Bristol, which I have to say, you know, got to admit, the Green Party are running a very, very good campaign.
Well, I'm getting something through my Bristol Central door every day.
Well, so am I. I mean,
every single day. Another one.
Funnily enough, I was talking to a
saying vote Green.
I was talking to a journalist from Politics Home yesterday, and I said one of the things I'm really interested in is how they are paying for this. If you just not how they're paying for it, because they're using members' money, but how they are getting away with so much stuff. The number of Facebook ads and the number of stuff coming through the doors. If I was Labour, I'd be going, can we have a look at the accounts? Because they must be overspending on this campaign. I just can't see how they cannot be. But, you know,
that's they're throwing everything into it, and they probably win. I think yesterday's one was the funniest so far. It was, I'm a doctor, and there's a lady with a stethoscope saying, you know, I was part of the Labour Party and I just found it, had enough of it. The Green Party are going to be really doing well for the for the NHS and this sort of thing. So I suppose they're thinking, well, maybe people will vote Labour because they think Labour's going to be best for the NHS, but they've got a special... Today's leaflet is all about how, no, the Greens are going to be really good. But anyway, I'd like to just talk about briefly, not go into too much depth, about our being cancelled from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft. So I got an email on Monday. It says, hi, Tony, from Chloe Slater. At prsc.org.uk, Chloe at prsc.org.uk. We understand it hasn't been too easy to share the space, that's the studio we've been using, over the last few months. We appreciate your efforts to make it work. We also appreciate all of the work that you and Dave have done around the radio suite over the years, and we take responsibility for not pushing the radio further when you were willing to help us out. We've recently become aware of some transphobic material that was left both in the leaflet box outside the studio and pinned to the board outside. You've been asked previously to be careful about the type of material brought into the building by you or your guests. We don't believe that you would have been unaware or just how inappropriate and offensive it would be to users of our building. It's vital we maintain an environment that welcomes all of our community, except you. And we consider this an extremely serious breach of that trust. In light of this, we will no longer be able to offer you use of the radio suite. Please let us know when you or Dave would like to come and retrieve your equipment and drop off your keys. On behalf of PRSC directors as well, the chair of the directors, Keith Cowling's name is Needham on here. I don't know if he wants us to repeat the name Keith Cowling as the chair of the directors of PRSC, but it's quite frustrating. What do you make of that, Jude? Because this for us, this is... I had to say when we went to pick our equipment up, can you show us this leaflet? I mean, I hadn't seen a leaflet. Someone had left a leaflet behind. I hadn't seen it.
So you don't even know what the crime is that supposedly has been committed?
No.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because that's kind of how it works, isn't it? So my crime, apparently, was running a webinar that was called Policy, Governance and the Law in the Green Party, where, talking to a barrister, I discussed three recent court cases where big institutions had been found guilty of discrimination because they'd called something transphobic when it wasn't, because there's a lot of this that goes on, isn't there? So that was the basis of apparently one of my crimes. But what that's doing there is just outright discrimination, isn't it? And you said to me earlier, will I be taking them to court? Well, yes, of course I will. Yesterday, a Free Speech Union sent the Green Party executive a very long and detailed legal letter explaining exactly what they'd done wrong. Because free speech in this country is a given, and you can't just say you had a transphobic leaflet and therefore we're sacking you. I mean, I suppose they can if you weren't paying
any
rent.
Somebody came in with a transphobic leaflet.
But what do they even call that? Is it a Posy Parker leaflet? Is that what it was? I mean, what was it?
I mean, it was becoming awkward to share the studio with the trans radio people simply because we kept turning up and finding that the stuff wasn't working and the wires were unplugged and all this sort of thing. But anyway, I just thought it was a very unkind way to do it without even asking kind of for a discussion.
But this is the thing, isn't it? Because interestingly, I was looking back at some emails today because I used to be on the committee, the same committee that sacked me, years ago, because I've had various different positions in the Green Party. I've been on the regional committee, I've been coordinator of Bristol Green Party, and I found an email from about 2015, I think, that said, that talked about somebody we'd been having a problem with. And in that instance, there was stuff about, I went to give have a chat with them, we talked about how things could be made better, you know, this sort of thing. And looking forward to now, thinking, now what happens is, everything that happened to me, for example, has all been done by email. No human person has actually spoken to me.
Maybe it was a AI bot that did it.
Well, it could have been an AI bot for all the care and empathy that went on. This is the thing, isn't it? The People's Republic to Soapscroft has always been, for me, a very kind of iconic and interesting organisation. And people look at Soapscroft, don't they, and think that's part of the radical, you know, different, whatever that is.
Well, the famous thing was the bear they put up in the bear pit, which was also a big advertising board, which was in the face of anyone coming into Bristol pretty much around that area. That got then taken down by Bristol's City Council security people, even though the PRSC were people were supposed to be curating it. But then the presence in the city has kind of gone downhill. I know there was all sorts of threats by the council to impose full business rates on them, and this was used as a sort of bargaining chip, I think, over a period of time. So the idea is, look, we won't impose full council full business rates on you because you're a voluntary organisation, basically a charity. You know, well, they were certainly not a business. But anyway, they have now, first of all, they got rid of the founder, Chris Chalkley. He was moved out of the way, had a mental breakdown as a result of that. He was the guy that originally invited us in. And then also other staff who were very sympathetic to what we were doing were also disappeared, maybe just purely naturally. But it's become something else. It's become almost difficult to say exactly, but something has gone, something has been lost from the place.
But I think that's what that's kind of one of the things we're talking about here.
Soul,
isn't it?
Maybe.
It
soul.
Is to do with soul. So I suppose that's really, to get back to the other question about when I joined the Green Party.
Do you believe in evolution? Soul.
But there's something, isn't there, about being able to have a conversation with someone you disagree with, about having a rigorous conversation, about political discourse, about intellectual discourse, and saying, you say that, I say this. There's something about compromise, which is really interesting, isn't there, which is, you know, with the new makeup of the council, how do you get a compromise decision or a consensus decision when you've got a huge Green group, a smaller Labour group, you know, the tiny Tories that are left, and there's a few Liberals hanging on, isn't there? When you know, because you look at that and think there's supposedly going to be consensus, but every single committee will be heavily weighted to the Greens. They're not good at listening. I'll just say that, you know, so they're not good at listening to other people's points of view. It's been made really obvious to me. And so how do you get any kind of actual intellectual movement forward or thinking about the best ideas?
I can remember, I think it was a Russian newspaper article talking about President Zelensky saying that it was like getting on with him being in charge of Ukraine. It was like getting onto an aircraft with a guy who's dressed like a pilot and he's got all the right jargon that a pilot says, but he's actually never flown a plane and he's just about to fly you. So it's like people who are in these political positions, but actually they don't really, they're in there for whether it is it's a bit someone like Biden, you know, who's just going to follow a script. Someone like Starmer is going to follow a script, but they're not actually political leaders. They're almost like actors in that role. So is it? I mean, okay, you might be having a go at the Green Party one step too far here, a bridge too far. But do you think that that's what we've got in the Green Party too, as well as some of the other parties, leaders who are just there reading a script rather than leading?
Sadly, I am going to say yes. I think at the moment that is what we see. It's interesting, isn't it? What makes me sad at the moment about this is this whole, we're the party that does politics differently. We're all about hope. We're all about change. We're all about listening. We're all about whatever. But inside, it's not doing that at all. So at the moment, you've even got this going on at the top of the party. You've got Carla Denyer saying all this stuff about hope and all the rest of it, although but knowing very well that women are being expelled from the party, people are being treated badly. We've got a really big problem with retention of members of the party who aren't white. you've got a lot of problems, but I think there's something about you can only rise up in the party if you've got a certain set of beliefs, and you can only be given the huge amount of help and support. It's cost hundreds of thousands of pounds to get Carla into being an MP next week, and so she's the chosen one. And then from that moment on, I'm not even sure there's a script. I think it's about it is about playing a part. But one of my criticisms of the party has been that we had Carla and Adrian, the leaders of the party, but also the MP candidates. So the leadership part has just been completely lost. They've not been leading. There's no leadership going on at all. All they're doing is being MP candidates and show ponies for the organisation.
This is so depressing. Even the new up-and-coming parties are just as bad as the old ones. But is there any hope, do you think? I mean, can you see anywhere? I mean, for politics in Britain?
I don't know. I think it's...
It's a week to go before the vote, or less, isn't it? You know, hopefully this is where we get rid of those intruders, imposters, and we get a few human beings in charge.
I don't know. It's interesting, isn't it, when you look at the state of British politics at the moment and think, are we just swapping one terrible lot for some people who are slightly better? And then you've got, oh, well, let's have the slightly better people and let's have three or four Greens holding them to account. Now, what person thinks that four Green MPs inside a, you know, huge Labour majority is going to hold anybody to account? Couldn't hold Labour to account when we were here on a local authority. So I don't know. I think it's really interesting looking at reform. I know people are very critical about the whole, you know, it's just a private business and it's run by one guy. But Farage is a very, very charismatic and I think intelligent bloke, actually. I know he's a horrible piece of work and all the rest of it, but he's not being taken seriously enough by the opposition. I think it's very, very dangerous to see what's going on.
I mean, the state of British comedy is very sad at the moment. And I think one of the reasons is that the only really good stand-up comedians now seem to be the likes of Farage. Actually, George Galloway does it as well sometimes, and some of the fringe political figures look better because our stand-up comedy, you know, generally, at least on television anyway, is so awful. Anyway, so at least that you think. Do you think there's any light at the end of the tunnel? Finally,
by light at the end of the tunnel
for Britain, you know, for our politics, for Westminster, for. Policies for decision making for the planet, for the Ukraine war, which seems to be on the horizon.
No, I don't think I do. I feel quite despondent about it, really, to be honest, at the moment. It's like, where is the hope? I mean, it's all very well to put loads of leaflets to the doorstep saying, you know, vote Green and there'll be hope. Yeah. But for me, it's like there's got to be delivery. I can't see where the delivery is coming from.
We're voting for these parties, aren't we? Actually, we're not voting for the people who are going to represent us. We're voting for a party. Isn't it party politics? Maybe that's the problem.
Well, I think it is the problem, and in fact, you know, the whole system we've got is based on, well, you said it before we were on air, it's big business that controls the politics, and that's the problem. Yeah. Now, when I was a Green, I would have said, well, that's one of the reasons Greens are different, because Greens aren't controlled by big business, but of course, they are, just in the same way. It'd be interesting to see how long it takes the Green Party to change its rules to say, we will accept donations from business. It can't be far away before they go, we're missing a trick here, we need to get bigger, we're going to say, you know, Dale Vince, please give us some money instead of giving it to the Labour Party, and be much more aggressive about that. I don't hold out much hope, actually. I think the political system's absolutely broken.
Martin?
Well, I think that it's... We are where we are.
Oh, come on, you can't.
No,
I know it's a cliche, but
it is broken.
Well, it is broken, but it was broken in Northern Ireland in 1969. It led to a war with all sorts of death and destruction. Two Tory prime ministers were nearly killed. And at the end of it, it was resolved. One of the things we are lacking is PR, which is exactly what was necessary to bring the two sides together in Northern Ireland. Because previously, it was a gerrymandered system. The nationalists could never get anybody elected. When they went out and protested about it, they were shot down and then they took up arms. And this is the danger, because we're going to go into the biggest economic crisis of our lifetimes very shortly. And if we don't get our politics straightened out by listening to everybody, we're going to end up with a civil war.
Okay, so let's just give the final word to Jude on that.
Well, no, I'm going to agree with you there. Yeah, we do need PR. That'll bring with it a whole different set of issues and problems.
It's not a solution. It's just a necessary thing.
It's a change. But how is that going to happen? Keir Starmer said this week he's not going to do it. And the Greens, for example, they don't make that a cornerstone of any of their political messaging. You won't find that in any of these leaflets that are coming through the door for this election. So, you know, are Carla and Adrian and the other Green MPs going to hold the Labour Party to account over that? Well, they can't, can they? So we know that Labour doesn't want to give away power. That's one of the things Labour's been very, very good at over the years. You know, they're an old party and they know how to do it. Greens look at Labour and think, well, we'll learn the same tricks. I mean, they're turning into the Labour Party in a lot of ways, you know?
The answer to that is, in Northern Ireland, there will always be PR in the elections to the Assembly, because that's one of the things that's absolutely central to the Good Friday Agreement, and in Scotland, and in Wales, just over the river. And that means that Britain is in the same... I used to be an aid worker in Yugoslavia in the 90s. It's actually a multinational state. And because it's been run by this, you know, conservative bloc in England because of first past the post, we've had all sorts of decisions which most people didn't agree with, rammed down their throats. Most people in Scotland are absolutely appalled with everything that's happened since 1980. And, of course, at some point that turns into, like Slovenia and Yugoslavia were one out of this. And that can then lead to, as in the Ukraine and lots of other places, it can lead to violence.
Well, from what you're saying, you'd think that Starmer would say that within this Parliament, I will bring PR in. So why is he not doing it?
He's not doing that because he doesn't, for the reasons you said, they don't want to give up power. But they may be forced to give up power. It's quite possible that the Labour Party, for example, are going to lose seats on their left. In Scotland, you know, Starmer's position on Gaza has gone down like a lead balloon in places like Scotland. That's not what people think.
I think he made a really big misstep.
Yes, a very big misstep.
It's one of the reasons I think Thangam is going to lose here, is because, you know, Greens played a clever move with suddenly going, you know, we're going to make that forefront of what we campaign against.
It's not just a clever move. If you think about the history of Bristol West, now Bristol Central, it was a Labour, solid Labour stronghold. Valerie Davey was the MP, and she had been a CND supporter and so on. But in the run-up to the Iraq war, she didn't vote for the war, but she didn't vote against it. And the kind of people who live around here weren't happy with that, and they voted Liberal Democrat as a way of punishing their own... You know, there's a radical vote in this constituency which doesn't belong to any party. As you can see what's happening in Brighton, where the Greens have been running the council and having Caroline as the MP for years, it looks as if the Labour Party might take that Green seat.
That's interesting
because of course, they've been running the council for such a long time, everybody's fed up with that.
The votes are just about voting somebody out.
That's what first past the post is about.
The one that they're most worried about, my moles in the Green Party, because obviously I still talk to people inside it, say that they are very worried about Brighton. Of course, that is what's happening there, is voting out some, you know, it's a punishment vote. And over here, it's the opposite. In a way, it's interesting, Thangam kept herself away from Marvin, I think, but it doesn't matter, does it? She's tainted.
Well, she's done some terrible things, like not turning up for hustings and things like that, because she doesn't.
Well, Marvin, incidentally, mentioning him, when Corbyn put himself forward and has made the candidate of the left, Marvin, all the Labour MPs in Bristol were totally opposed to Corbyn. They didn't want Corbyn. They campaigned against him. They were unhappy that he managed to be the leader. But Marvin took the position as, I'm not taking sides on this. I'm the mayor of Bristol. I'm therefore I'm perfectly happy to work with Jeremy Corbyn.
He knew that Corbyn's cards were marked. He's not going to.
I think in actual fact Marvin's got his own political calculations running in his brain. You know.
Anyway, what's his job now?
He's going to be an environmental honorary professor on building monstrosities.
No. Anyway, look, Jude, thanks ever so much for joining us. If any people want to follow what you're up to, are there good places online to find out what's happening with your case, etc.?
Well, I suppose I've got a tiny Twitter account. I'm such a terrible risk, you know. I've got a Twitter account of about 1,300 followers. But there will be stuff coming out. There will be a crowdfunder. I'll let you know, Tony, when it's up.
Where can we find you on Twitter, then?
Jude Brew, @JudeBrew. And if people want to look at the background to all of this, there is something called the Green Women's Declaration. It's a website. Just look it up, Green Women's Declaration. We've got a list of all the people that have been expelled, all the laws that have been broken, the reasons. It's a copy. There'll be a copy of my complaint up there because I've made my complaint not confidential. Good. Because I want everybody Good. To see what a complete yeah. load of nutters they are. And the Free Speech Union letter that went out yesterday is pinned to the top of my Twitter account. And that's a very interesting document. They've been very, very helpful, I have to say. Excellent young, very, very clever staff who get this stuff straight away. And I have to say a great deal of thanks to them, actually.
So, Jude English, thanks very much for joining us. We're going to go in and have a listen now. Sticking the knife into Starmer is good old Peter Hitchens.
Normally, you're leading the charge of despair against the Conservatives, but you seem to be more worried about Keir Starmer's Labour Party than almost Jeremy Corbyn's.
If you want to have a quick chorus, if you hate the Tory party, clap your hands. I'll cheerfully lead it or join in. I still loathe the Tory party. But there are moments when you want to have it destroyed and thrown in the bin and carted away, and moments when actually it might be sensible to hang on. This is one of those moments. The Starmer Labour Party is very similar in character to the Blair Labour Party of 1997. You can tell just by looking at it that it has an enormous amount of menacing things in its mind to do.
Such as?
You don't know what they are. Well, look, think two, three things that the Blair government did within pretty much weeks of coming to office. Bank of England independence, the colossal raid on the pension funds, and the appointment of Alistair Campbell and Jonathan Powell to give orders to civil servants in breach of the Constitution.
Were they really calamities? Every major G7 economy in the world has got Bank of England, Central Bank independence, a personnel special advisor, a number 10. You're really saying the Blair government was Blair government?
The appointment of Alistair Campbell to give orders to civil servants without responsibility to Parliament was a political revolution. And it's done immense and lasting damage to the neutrality of the civil service. Bank of England independence takes away government control from one of the most key decisions any government can take on interest rates. It's absurd. And the raid on pension funds, I think anybody who was remotely affected by it must recognize it was basically disastrous for the pension system, and also straightforward political robbery of people who'd saved all their lives to look after themselves in retirement.
I'm not going to make it
all indefensible. The thing was that indefensible as they were also not announced. They just did them. And I see absolutely no reason to believe why a Starmer government won't do things of that nature as well. I wrote this morning about their constitutional plans, which nobody's interested in at all, but which are enormous and all-embracing. When will people ever understand? Poor old Jeremy Corbyn, steam-powered Edwardian Marxist-Leninist, made no secret of what it was he was up to, hadn't adjusted any of his ideas really at all, so he was basically spouting stuff which went out of style in the international left in the 1960s. Totally harmless, because you could see him coming a mile off. The modern left proceeds by subtle salami slicing and round the back methods to achieve its action. Look at what Peter Hyman wrote in The Observer a few years ago. He said that a new Labour as a project was far more revolutionary than anything Corbyn ever contemplated. I've known people in New Labour. My old friend Philip Bassett, who I knew when he was on the Financial Times and the Times as a Labour correspondent, when he went just before the 1997 election to work for New Labour, we had a farewell lunch because we knew that once he worked for Blair, we wouldn't be having much to do with each other. And he said, "You have no idea how extensive this project is." And I sort of did, because I knew a bit about Blairism, but I didn't, he was quite right. I didn't know anything like how extensive it was in terms of the constitutional and the cultural and the moral changes and the educational changes which would result from it. And the country is now almost unrecognizable from what it was in 1997, but the job's not finished.
So what he's saying, Peter Hitchens, there is suggesting, Martin, I think you should answer some of those questions, because he's saying that actually the left is not really the left. It's part of a much, much bigger project. And he's speaking there specifically about some of the measures brought in by Tony Blair to regionalise Britain, basically balkanise, break up Britain, to bring in these new parliaments in order to really set the country against itself. But also, of course, that corporatisation, things like these public-private partnerships, the privatisation of the National Health Service, these are all part of the Labour project. And that's what he's implying there, that there's actually a lot more to Labour than we're led to believe, certainly from the old school, you know, something from the 1970s and the origins of the party. It's now become a neoliberal party, which is using this kind of left-wing cover, really, to bring in things which are actually far more radical than maybe even the Tories would.
Well, it's certainly true that it's a neoliberal party, but then that's been the row that we've been having within the Labour Party for the last 50 years, including the whole Corbyn era and all the rest of it. Starmer is definitely very much on the right of the party, and he's definitely in the pocket of big business. You know, I mean, he makes a virtue of how establishment he is. On the question of the breakup of Britain, which Tony Blair supposedly brought in.
Well, he did.
Well, all right, can I just finish? That was because there was a massive, massive demand for this in Scotland and ultimately in Wales. And, of course, Ireland's got a completely different politics. No, there are no Tories or Labour Party standing in the six counties as we speak, and there never have been. This is a multinational state, like Yugoslavia. It always has been. And that's nothing to do with Tony Blair. Tony Blair was not that happy about having to bring in devolution. It was just one of the things he had to do because of the pressures that had been put on the Labour Party in Scotland by the Scottish.
So it wasn't a sort of Trojan horse at all, though.
No.
It wasn't part of the European Union's plans to regionalise the whole of Europe.
No, the European Union is. The real problem in this country is this country is run by NATO, by the Americans. And the problem is that the Scots, if there was Scottish independence, it was in their manifesto that we've got to get rid of Faslane from where it is.
But none of this matters. None of this matters really because Starmer is going to win, isn't he?
He is.
Week?
Yes, but he's not necessarily going to win outright. And then there's all sorts of problems are going to emerge. So it's not so straightforward. I mean, Peter Hitchens has got some of the things right there. The Labour Party has drifted to the right from his point of view and my point of view.
For me, that this election has been dominated by the Uni Party. Very boring candidates, Starmer seems exciting compared to Rishi Sunak, who seems to me to be just like a kind of used car salesman. But the interesting aspect, from my point of view, is what we just heard from Jude, the Greens, a very, very flawed party, up and coming, and as it becomes, it seems, closer to power, the party is more and more controlled from the top, more and more control freaks moving in. But Reform UK and George Galloway's Workers' Party aren't really like that, and we're joined now in a studio in the cafe, because we're actually in the cafe here at the Coombe Centre today, by Paul MacDonald. Hi, Paul.
How are you? Hi.
Very well. Can you just give us a bit about your background and where you're standing for the Reform UK party?
Well, my background is that I'm from South Dublin. I went to Trinity College Dublin, studied medieval English and philosophy. And I left, went to the UK, worked for government relations company Hill & Knowlton during the 1980s.
What relations?
Government relations, government affairs.
So is that
lobbying?
Lobbying, yeah.
Lobbying.
Okay.
I represented big American corporations and things like that to legislators. And I then went back to Ireland and I got involved and became the executive director of a think tank called the Edmund Burke Institute.
The what?
The Edmund Burke Institute.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And we then launched another think tank called Open Republic. And it was essentially a pro-free market, slightly libertarian, Austrian economics, Hayekian think tank.
Martin, do you want to just explain that a little bit? We talk a lot about economics on here, Martin is also...
I would be on the opposite end of the spectrum in terms of economic thinking, but I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, so can you explain that?
Well, Hayekian think... there was a consensus in the mainstream, as Paul will know, from the 1940s into the 1970s, that it was, for want of a better word, called the Keynesian consensus. Because I used to teach A-level economics, and the students had to learn both the Keynesian picture of how the economy works and the opposite picture, which was the monetarism, as it was called in those days in the 80s, but now it's called Austrian economics. And, of course, these are two different philosophies of how the economy works. Can I just say from my own Keynesian point of view that what's happened in the last 20 years in this country is absolute it just shows, for example, George Osborne brought in austerity to reduce the country's deficit. The economy started to go down and the deficit increased, which is exactly what Keynes would have predicted. And, of course, he lost the country's AAA credit rating by doing that.
Paul, can you just give us your take? Can you give us your take, since we're on this topic of economy, which is one thing that is almost like a dark art for a lot of people.
I want to explain what Hayekin, what Hayek's insights were. Friedrich Hayek was part of the Austrian school. Another great member of that is Ludwig von Mises. And Hayek's view of economics was really a kind of an extended, almost anthropological view. The idea where, let me just put this as precise as I can. Well, I'll sort of give you the conclusion and then I'll explain what it means. As far as Hayek was concerned, and this is my own reading of Hayek, and I've read most of Hayek. Hayek's opinion was that Austrian economics was to political economy as Darwin's theory of natural selection was to life on Earth. In other words, Austrian economics is not a prescriptive theory. It's an explanation. Okay? And he said that Hayek commented about Darwin's theory of natural selection. He said the empirical content of the theory of natural selection consists in what it forbids. In other words, you can never predict that any species will arise from evolution. Now, that's the way he viewed it, and that's my reading of how he viewed it. Therefore, if Austrian economics is to political economy as the theory of natural selection is to life on Earth, socialism and central planning is to political economy as creationism is to life on Earth. In other words, it's a mind first planning understanding of how the economy works that centers in governments and in planners and in authorities and in experts the brains, the ratiocination, the ideation of how the economy should be. So the Hayekians aren't really that concerned with how the economy should be planned. They don't believe in planning. So Hayekians don't believe in planning the economy any more than Darwinians believe that animals should look any particular way. It's just an explanation. That said, obviously, Hayekians, like Hayek, he described himself as a Burkean Whig. So Hayekians, generally speaking, will believe in the rule of law, they will believe in institutions, they will have certain conservative characteristics. But as far as the economy is concerned, they think that the idea that you can plan the economy is absurd.
Okay, so how... Yeah, but I mean,
it's all very well to chit-chat
about all this stuff, but what's going on right now is the super rich are getting more and more and more super rich, the poor are getting poorer and poorer, and we're now in the situation where work is really no longer a route out of poverty. Many people starting their jobs will end up with less money in their pocket than they would have done on benefits, and that's not because the benefits are high, they're not high. They're just subsistence allowance. So you have to intervene, don't you?
I think policymakers can make things better. I mean, simply...
Don't you just let these poor people die?
I don't think in the Western world poor people are dying because of the economy. I think
drugs and things like that. They get they throw themselves off buildings.
There was a big increase in deaths during the austerity period, and in fact, in this country, the life expectancy for the first time in 100 years went down instead of up.
Doesn't everybody? Sure,
as a result of Osborne's belief in
your economics. Doesn't everybody deserve the basics? Something to eat, some water.
I think so. But I'm not defending the record of the Conservatives in office. I think the kind of policies I support and reform supports are to a large extent supply side policies. But in fact, I'm quite keen, for example, that we build enough houses so that housing is more affordable. Well, it's affordable. To younger people on lower incomes, and I'm fairly radical about that, and I think that involves standing up to vested interests. So I'm quite keen that we should stand up to vested interests. Now, at the same time, I also think that a lot of, and this is a personal view, that a lot of vernacular architecture in Britain that's used for housing is of very poor quality. So if the state is going to intervene, it should intervene in the sense of insisting on certain levels of quality and, frankly, architectural quality. We tend to build houses in this country on the basis...
We're just about to see all that thrown out of the window, aren't we, with the Labour's plans to scrap... I mean, we've seen it already in the last few years with the Conservatives.
Well, Labour are...
Really, they are pretty much preparing to tear up many of the planning rules, saying that the developers are saying we can't build enough homes, and so we're going to try and... Well, it's going to be a bonfire of the planning regulations. This is what Labour are talking about.
Yeah, I don't know what the details are. I mean, Labour are planning to build a lot of council houses. This is not necessarily a bad thing. It's just, you know, from my point of view, it's just that we need more supply, and the rules of supply and demand work in housing as well as much as anything else. The more supply you have, the price goes down, and the price needs to go down.
So anyway, this week has been quite rocky rough for Reform UK. I think it's fair to say Farage has lit the bonfire under the possibility of getting quite a lot of votes. And looking at these Channel 4 News' expose yesterday on some of the views of the Reform UK candidates and supporters, particularly nasty ones from the supporters, we're going to have a listen now to an extract from Channel 4 News last night. It's called Undercover, Inside Reform's Campaign, Evidence of Homophobia and the Canvassers' Racism. So that's a couple of minutes. We'll come back to talk to Paul McDonnell, who's... where is it you're a candidate for?
North East Somerset and Hannam.
So you're up against Rees-Mogg, are you?
Jacob Rees-Mogg is the sitting MP for the previous constituency. It's changed. The boundaries have changed.
So you're up against him, are you?
Well, him, really. Dan Maybe. Norris, really, as well, is his favourite. So
it's a marginal, isn't it, these days?
Before we hear this undercover investigation thing from Channel 4, who's going to win your constituency?
I think Labour are favourite to win.
Really?
Clearly, okay. Yeah.
Well, you're making sure of that, aren't you, by standing against Rees-Mogg?
Well, currently, if you look at the polls and you add, if you assume every single person who's going to vote for me would, if I didn't stand, vote for Jacob Rees-Mogg, he still wouldn't win.
Oh, really?
And there's no way that everybody who's going to vote for me would vote for Jacob Rees-Mogg come hell or high water. So, I think it's the change of the boundary and has given Labour a huge advantage. But certainly we are. I mean, we are taking
substantial
votes from
him. Yeah, he was the MP there. I mean, we had him on this show. Probably was it 12 years ago. He was the MP for that area previously. Anyway, let's have a listen to Channel 4 News now, digging the dirt on Reform UK and some of their supporters and candidates. Very controversial and homophobic, etc., and racist views.
We meet Andrew Parker, who describes himself as a property dealer. Mr. Parker tells our investigator he's known Farage for years.
Yeah, I met him in a restaurant in London.
Yeah.
The Reform canvasser then gives his view on Muslims and what the party would do with mosques.
Sick mother. It's a cult. Lord, I tell you what, if you don't know about Islam, it's the most disgusting cult ever. Kicking all the Muslims out of the mosques and then serving them in the Witherspoons.
As well as his opinion on the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak.
Yeah. I've always been a Tory voter. What annoys me is, the f*** he got, what's good is he? You tell me, you know, he's just wet.
What, Sunak?
He gives his views on how to stop the boats.
DL11 in a place near Dover, army recruiting, get the young recruits there, with guns on the beach, target practice, just shoot them. That's what the Greeks done, you know about that, the Greeks shot at us.
Look at the Australians, I don't want none of it.
I've just seen the ring fence Bradfistan round and just do that f***ing
rolls off.
You've got these bastards running our country, must be f***ing joking, mate.
Good luck.
Keep flying that flag.
I will too.
The reason I'm going to Reform is because the situation is that Rishi Sunak ain't worth pissing on, to be honest.
Mr. Parker urges this undecided voter, who says he's a paramedic, to help get Nigel Farage elected. And he offers this advice for treating migrants in his ambulance.
And do us a favour, if you're a paramedic and not getting your ambulance, just dump oxygen on the bar so you say else. You know where I'm coming from.
That's a yes.
In a statement, Andrew Parker told us, "I'd like to make clear neither Nigel Farage personally nor the Reform Party were aware of my personal views on immigration. I therefore would like to apologise to them if my personal views have reflected badly on them and brought them into disrepute." As Farage's campaign team enjoy a drink in the sunshine, a police car drives by.
This is the shit I'm talking about. That is outrageous.
The car has a pride flag on its bonnet.
You see that degenerate flag on the front bonnet? What the old Bill doing promoting that crap? He's about catching nonsense, not promoting it.
I mean, the car doesn't even look particularly... Well, when we form the government in 2029, then surely we can change lots of things.
But, mate, yeah, the policemen going to gay pride marches rather than doing their job to be the first on the list.
I'm surprised there's not an Islamic flag on the back of it.
Well, exactly. But that's the irony of it, though, Roger. That's the irony, mate. That lot and the other lot have got some sort of weird sort of agreement. It's like sort of Stalin and Hitler before they invaded Poland together. You know, and actually, the irony of it is, if the Islamists take over, the people on the front bonnet will be the first up against the wall. Yeah, of course they are!
How do we help them?
Well, I suggest all our police officers go down to the local gay pride march and dance around like fairies for a few days.
You'll help.
At the taxpayers' expense.
And involvement.
It's not like we've got a crime wave hitting this country, is it? So why not? They've got time to kill.
Yeah, but aren't we just going to feed
this
the problem?
This is virtue signalling nonce bullshit.
Virtue signalling nonce bullshit, he says. So you do, in your party, have a bit of a problem with Islamophobia and homophobia, to say the least, don't you?
I mean, he said quite a lot of stuff there, actually. And I mean, I think that sounds to me like an issue of vetting people. You are aware that Nigel Farage's team are saying that he's an actor.
Oh, that's right. Yes, I'd heard that earlier.
And they're sort of suggesting that he sort of inserted himself into the campaign.
Well, that's a possibility, but it's much more likely, surely, that he's just a racist grunt that's been accepted by Reform UK to help out.
I doubt it. I mean, Reform do vet people. This sounds like a failure of vetting to me.
Well, he's not even a candidate, is he?
Well, he's just somebody helping
this
out.
This guy's not a candidate, no. He's a canvasser. But, I mean, when views like this are tolerated within the party and this guy is not told, well, no, we're not going to have you knocking on doors because of these views, I mean, they obviously know what his views are.
I don't think views like that are tolerated in the party. If for no other reason, I mean, sorry.
Well, they are. They are there. I mean, they clearly were there by other people in the party.
Well, I immediately, people who express these kind of views in the party are booted out of any kind of campaign teams because clearly, you know, these kind of views are reputationally not good for any party. And you know, Reform isn't the only party to vet people who've occasionally expressed very extreme and very strange views.
To sort of weigh in on Farage's behalf, I mean, he hasn't been part of the vetting process. He's only become leader very recently, the last minute. So this isn't really necessarily... I don't think the main problem has been Tice and his, you know, his stewardship of the party rather than Farage.
This isn't that big a deal. This is some lowly volunteer with very earthy opinions that you might hear in a pub in Clacton, and he's sounding off. And
Martin, does it matter?
Well, it does matter in the sense that everything in an election campaign matters, doesn't it? I think the other interesting thing from my point of view is Nigel Farage's comments on Ukraine, which I tend to agree with.
Let's hear those now.
Yeah.
You blame the West, not him. You said, I'll just read it to you and then you can react, that on a tweet, it was a consequence of EU and NATO expansion. Is that a judgment you stand by?
Right. I'll tell you what you don't know. I stood up in the European Parliament in 2014 and I said, and I quote, there will be a war in Ukraine. Why did I say that? It was obvious to me that the ever eastward expansion of NATO and the European Union was giving this man a reason to his Russian people to say they're coming for us again and to go to war.
But you were echoing him.
Sorry?
You were echoing him. That's what Putin says.
No. Sorry, I've been saying this actually since the 1990s. Ever since the fall of the wall. But hang on a second. We provoked this war. Of course it's his fault. He's used what
we've
done.
But we provoked the invasion of Ukraine.
Yes, and very interestingly, once again, 10 years ago when I predicted this, by the way, I'm the only person in British politics that predicted what would happen. And of course, everyone said I was a pariah for daring to suggest it. George Robertson, former Labour cabinet minister, who went on to become the Secretary General of NATO, has in the last couple of weeks said the war is a direct result of EU expansionism.
So there you have it. What do you make of his comments, Paul?
I've become more impressed with Nigel Farage since the beginning of this campaign.
So you agree with that?
No, let me explain.
You don't agree with
him. He's developed a real nuance and a real grasp of international policy and affairs, and he's a good high-level thinker about policy. So let me tell you what I think about all this. I think the media have difficulty grasping the fact that two things can be true at the same time. It is the case that the EU and NATO, when they reached out to Ukraine, were acting legitimately. It is also the case that when they failed to anticipate what Russia might do in response, they were acting irresponsibly. In other words, it was a strategic failure on their part to anticipate how Russia might react. That's a mistake. And that in fact, was provocative to Putin. It is also the case that Putin's invasion of Ukraine was entirely unjustified and should be opposed. Now, all of those things can be true at the same time.
With British weapons? With British special forces?
Well, I mean, let me give you, and this is my own opinion. I think there is something slightly weak about just simply giving all these weapons to Ukraine and the war going on for so long. I suspect that if the United States and or NATO had directly threatened Russia before Russia invaded Ukraine, and they were aware that it was going to happen beforehand, had they threatened them as follows: everything that you put across the border into Ukraine, we will attack, it's guaranteed, and we'll do so immediately with overwhelming force, I suspect Putin might have blinked. Where was he going to escalate from there? And I think he would have blinked. But that said, you know, all of that carries risks. But I think Nigel Farage's observation that NATO and the EU provoked Putin is manifestly the case, and that is not endorsing Putin's decision to invade.
Do you think Putin does want to take over the whole of Ukraine? Do you think he's got has he ambitions of empire?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I'm not an expert on the politics of that region. It seems that he wants to inflict some kind of humiliation on Ukraine, and he doesn't want NATO countries on his border because it hurts his pride.
I'm not sure if you know, but over the last few weeks there have been attacks using NATO targeting satellites and NATO weapons by the Ukrainians, apparently, not by NATO countries, on a nuclear bomber base in Russia. Also the early warning nuclear ballistic missile radar stations, three of them in Russia, also attacked. The Russians are saying this isn't, we're not fighting NATO. And at some point, of course, we had this with the attack on Sevastopol as well this week. The Russians are saying we're not fighting Ukraine anymore. We know we're fighting NATO, and at some point we're going to hit back. Now that could mean a bomb here in Britain. It could be, what do you make of that?
I don't believe there is going to be an escalation to that level. I think Russia is still on course, you know, long term. It has an advantage just in sheer numbers. It's a much bigger country than Ukraine. It hasn't even mobilized, you know, anything like its full military forces. And it can go on for a very, very long time, much longer than Ukraine. So I think Russia is going to play the long game. Russia is not going to escalate by attacking a NATO country. I don't believe that.
Well, if NATO are attacking them, they may. And there's a lot of pressure, internal pressure in Russia, saying we need to hit one of these countries. Show them, tell them to stop it. As an example.
It depends how they interpret it. I mean, he might be saying we consider this to be an attack by NATO when it's Ukraine using a NATO weapon. I mean, he might say that, but I don't think he's going to escalate.
Well, fingers crossed, eh? Anyway, let's listen back to 2014. 10 years ago exactly, not exactly, but around about 10 years ago, with Nigel Farage a UKIP member of the European Parliament speaking out against the Maidan coup and saying, we've got to be very careful here. We might provoke a war in Ukraine with Russia. So let's have a listen to Nigel Farage 10 years ago.
And the next speaker will be Honourable Farage, EFDR, in it.
Amongst the long lists of foreign policy failures and contradictions in the last few years, including, of course, the bombing of Libya, the desire to arm the rebels in Syria, has been the unnecessary provocation of Vladimir Putin. This EU empire, ever seeking to expand, stated its territorial claim on Ukraine some years ago. Just to make that worse, of course, some NATO members said they too would like the Ukraine to join NATO. We directly encouraged the uprising in the Ukraine that led to the toppling of the President Yanukovych, and that led, of course, in turn to Vladimir Putin reacting. And the moral of the story is, if you poke the Russian bear with a stick, don't be surprised when he reacts. Now, just to continue with that, today we are rushing through an association agreement at undue speed with the Ukraine, and as we speak, there are NATO soldiers engaged in military exercises in the Ukraine. Have we taken leave of our senses? Do we actually want to have a war with Putin? Because if we do, we're certainly going about it the right way. Perhaps we ought to recognise that the West now faces the biggest threat and crisis to our way of life that we have seen for over 70 years. The recent beheadings of the British and American hostages graphically illustrates the problem. And of course we have our own citizens from our own countries engaged in that struggle too. In the war against Islamic extremism, Vladimir Putin, whatever we may think of him as a human being, is actually on our side. I suggest we grow up. I suggest we recognise the real threat facing all of our countries, communities and societies. We stop playing war games in the Ukraine and we start to prepare a plan to help countries like Syria, like Iraq, like Kenya, like indeed Nigeria, to try and help them to deal with the real threat that faces us. Let's not go on provoking Putin, whether we like him or not.
Kiitoksia. Mr. Pascu, 30 seconds, please.
Sir, in your considerate opinion, what is better, to have Russian soldiers fighting a war on the territory of Ukraine or NATO troops exercising as a response to that on the territory of Ukraine?
Thank you. Mr. Farage, 30 seconds, please.
I think, sir, the point that I was making is that there should be a huge degree of guilt in this House about what provoked all of this in the first place, and we saw Western Ukrainians waving European flags, rioting, setting fire to things, and effectively staging a coup d'etat which brought down the Ukrainian president, which has led to this instability. Yes, yes, you are the guilty people, and you refuse to accept it.
Now, Martin, as a member of the Labour Party, what do you make of that speech by Farage 10 years ago?
Well, I'm a member of the Labour Party. I still remain a member of the Labour Party, but I have, as you know, Tony, been involved in East European affairs for a long time. I wrote a book with a Hungarian who became a European Commissioner, Laszlo Andor, and in the final chapter of the book, which was published in 1998, we said if they carry on with this policy, there's going to be a civil war in the Ukraine, it'll be about Crimea. And of course, he was not of your Hayekian persuasion. He was of my more left sure. Keynesian persuasion.
Sure.
So we were critiquing. The sure. book was called sure. Market Failure: Eastern Europe's Economic Miracle. Right. And it was about the we were critiquing the neoliberal policies that have been pursued.
But Martin,
what happened in Ukraine is all of the heavy industry is in the eastern part of the country, and it's mostly Russians who live there, and they've lived there since the 19th century.
Yeah.
The western part of the Ukraine was put into, this whole state has been created essentially by Lenin, Stalin, and the breakup of the Soviet Union. So it's a rather accidental state. The word Ukraine in both Polish and Russian means borderland. And it's a very flat place, so you've got lots of different...
But Martin, since Nigel Farage is saying there in the European Parliament exactly what you've been saying about what's been going on in Ukraine, why don't you just join Reform UK?
Well, no, I welcome him bringing this up. I don't share his Hayekian views of the economy. I welcome because...
But I just want to say, I mean, his analysis is astoundingly astute. I mean, it's an astoundingly good analysis. And he is head and shoulders above any other British politician in that regard.
Well, I don't think there's anybody else who's taken it seriously.
Maybe Galloway.
Galloway, yeah, to some extent, yeah, yes. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah, he probably shares those views.
The good news for Reform UK is that polls just out in the last couple of hours have put them now 3 points ahead of the Conservative Party. This is extraordinary, Martin, isn't it, to have a fringe party actually, you know, I mean, Sunak must be really, really bad to allow Reform UK to be 3 points ahead in the polls.
Well, we're having a realignment on the right of our politics, aren't we? Yeah. That's what's happening. Yeah.
Yeah. So has Sunak simply sabotaged the
Conservatives? No, I mean, the Conservatives sabotaged... Can I come back to...
Hear Paul on okay. that. Because he does seem to have done.
The Conservatives essentially are not... I mean, the Conservative Party are not... Oh, sorry. From my perspective, are not the Conservative Party and have not been really probably since the departure of Thatcher. What they did is I think they were overwhelmed in the 90s by a kind of cultural reevaluation amongst, I suppose, the media, amongst certainly the sort of cultural elites of Britain, who painted the Thatcher years as being a bit like the Third Reich. And so what they decided to do was become more warm and cuddly and consensus-driven, and in fact, at the end of the day, Keynesian. And the legacy of that is you have a Conservative Party that really is governing. I mean, it's presenting itself as being centre-right, but you know the state has been growing and growing and growing and growing. For me, what broke the camel's back was really lockdown. I think lockdowns were, and I said this before, Nigel Farage criticised it. I mean, I'd go further than Nigel. I would say the first lockdown was also a disaster. I mean, within 3 days of the first lockdown, I resigned from the Conservative Party, and I said to friends of mine, "This is the biggest public policy mistake since the First World War. It's a catastrophe." There was no basis in science for this. And one of the great problems we have in our society is that we have become instrumentalized. I don't know if you're aware of Ian McGilchrist's book, The Master and His Emissary, and he talks about society becoming ever more left brain focused. You know, we're becoming much more. It's a product of modernity to some extent.
When you say left
Ian
brain,
Gilmore,
can you,
the former Tory minister?
No, Ian McGilchrist.
Oh no, so this he's a neuroscientist. So when you're saying more left brain, what does that mean?
Well, what it means, the left brain supposedly is stronger at and better at identifying things, detail. It's better at certain kinds of function that require manipulation of objects or concepts. Whereas the right brain is more of a generalized envisioning sort of brain. So religious ideas are right brain. Political philosophies tend to be more right brain. But you know, planning, ideas of detail. His argument is that these two perspectives evolved from the earliest stages of mammalian life, where you had to, on one hand, catch your prey and kill it, which is sort of left brain, while at the same time keeping an eye out for predators, which is right brain, big picture stuff. So our society, his argument is, has progressively, and this is shown in philosophy, has become much more focused on process and detail. We've become very solutionist. We think that we think that scientists can solve everything. We also think that science is about making gadgets and solving particular problems, whereas in fact science has always been about simply explaining reality.
The science is itself under attack. We had by the way, it had been somehow nobbled on the BitChute platform. I couldn't read it, couldn't watch it, but we had a discussion with Dr. Chris Busby and Dr. Chris S. Exley in 2022 called "Is Science Dead?" where it talked about people that were doing the job that you used to do as lobbyists being so powerful that they were able to get scientists who came up with theories and were doing research which was bad for corporate profits being taken out of universities. So science itself is under attack, surely.
Well, the
isn't
problem,
it, Paul?
Well, the problem I'm kind of getting to is that we live in a society now where we trust scientists. So, for example, take climate change. There is good scientific evidence that climate change is happening. There's good evidence that this may become a problem in certain countries more than others. But there is absolutely no scientific support for the idea that it's A, an emergency, or B, that we need draconian net zero measures to deal with it. That's not scientifically grounded. COVID was obviously identified by epidemiologists, but the COVID measures, epidemiologists were no more qualified to determine what measures should be taken to counteract COVID, you know, than like, you know, a barman in your local pub.
Look, I would put this down to simple accelerationism, which is where solutions to crises are devised and implemented, which actually make the problem worse rather than better,
and make the government more powerful.
Quite often, yes. But I mean, Martin, you've got to. Can you just react to this? I mean, Reform UK have done an incredible job here. Maybe because Starmer has been so appallingly bad. Sorry. Sunak has been so poorly bad, but because the rows, I mean, this is the point, is the rows surrounding Nigel Farage's views, the Daily Express says today, on Ukraine have failed to deter momentum for Reform UK ahead of the general election. A new poll released just an hour or so ago, an exclusive poll for the Daily Express by Whitestone Insight, which surveyed 2012 people across Wednesday and Thursday this week, found Reform UK up 1 point with a whopping 21% compared to last week. So quite clearly something at the centre of British politics with the Uniparty has failed, hasn't it?
Well, as I said earlier, we're now seeing a realignment on the right of politics, pretty significant. You can think about the splitting of the Tory party over the Corn Laws in the 19th century. And, of course, what happened as a result of that is under a first-past-the-post system, it gives Starmer, you know, a supercharged.
Yeah, yeah.
From my left-wing point of view, I'm not necessarily very happy about that.
Sure. Yeah.
Coming back to we've debated COVID and Brexit. We've debated on here a lot of times, and because this isn't mainstream media, we can go into a bit of detail about the philosophy and the background to people's
which
ideas.
Is fantastic, yeah.
Yeah, this is what we do,
yeah, and it's important. Yeah,
of course it is, because people are just
Martin
giving the
sound is a big fan of lockdowns.
No, I wasn't a fan of lockdowns.
You are, and you love the Chinese.
The evidence is piling up that it was a biological warfare agent, and it was used to try and take down the Chinese economy, and then of course create governmental power in the West.
I don't want to get too drawn into this, Martin, because
okay,
I mean,
it's
a complete counter. It's a complete counter argument.
We're talking about the
danger of COVID-19 was nothing like what we were told in terms of. You know, the reaction to it being obviously, you know, if we had anthrax going around, yes, because this would be very,
we've
killing a lot of
many
people.
Times. Yeah. We don't have to repeat ourselves.
Anyway,
let's
let Paul wind up on talking about COVID and these measures.
Well, I think that my read of it is, and I put this in a tweet. Jonathan Haidt, the American psychologist, wrote a book called The Coddling of the American Mind. And his take
the
coddling of the
coddling,
American mind.
Okay.
They're sort of, you know, being overprotective. And I think what Haidt points out is one factor. So Haidt's idea is that, and Greg Lukianoff, I think, also was a co-author, I think. And essentially what they were saying was that in the 1990s, due partly to 24/7 TV and then the growth of cable TV, people became very sort of anxious because the media spread stories about things like childhood abduction and satanic cults and all this kind of stuff, and children were deemed to be vulnerable. And there were if a child, you know, was kidnapped, which could happen occasionally, the child might be murdered. And this all went like viral on TV in a way it would never have done a decade earlier. And this sort of sensitized parents to the dangers of to their children. Now, add to that another factor, which is the growth in corporate safetyism and the growth in the whole language of safetyism, and indeed the concept creep of safetyism from, you know, I don't want to get hurt to I don't want my feelings hurt, etc., etc. And so we ended up with a society that was very, very safety conscious, probably too much so. You know, children can't go on swings now because of health and safety and insurance and so on. And my sort of tweet at the time of lockdown was that Haidt and Lukianoff had pointed out that a generation of children had grown up whose parents could hardly let them outside the front door for fear that they would get abducted. Those children grew up to be today's public health scientists and public health bureaucrats, and that is why we are where we are. It is an anxious generation. And by the way, this also feeding into this is this whole left brain, is this whole kind of scientism, you know, where science is the solution. So you add scientism to all of this, and you end up with this kind of authoritarianism
Well, you're an ex-lobbyist. You must know the pharmaceutical industry is quite a powerful lobby. It just gets what it wants. It gets the scientists it wants.
I think in this case, yes, certainly. I mean, I would agree. I mean, in this case, I mean, I will blame the I don't believe in single causes. You know, when governments do bad things, maybe people on the left tend to blame their commercial lobbyists. I tend to blame the governments. There's lots of blame to go around. You know, a politician who was bribed by a corrupt businessman is considered more guilty in law than you know another official, because obviously a corrupt politician is going to undermine the state itself.
Well, if he gets found out, and most of them, yeah. This is what they do day after day after day, as far as I can see. Mm. Anyway, look, just to sort of getting towards the end of chatting with you, Paul. I hope you don't mind having a listen to this. This is a clip from Talk TV or Talk Radio, whatever they call it, the Murdoch channel, last Sunday with Peter Carswell. A very interesting chap phoned in about what he thinks is Keir Starmer's plan to join something called the European Defence and Security Union, which is effectively saying that, that it's quite likely, if the Labour Party get in, quietly what they're doing, they're cooking up behind the scenes, is this idea of you know, rejoining the EU by the back door and the British armed forces joining a kind of European army, an intelligence organisation.
A big article, actually, in the Sunday Times today by Tim Shipman, their chief political commentator, on why the parties aren't talking about Brexit. It is a huge issue. It happened. It is, you know, massive constitutional change. And David at Exeter has given me a ring. I think this is along the lines of what you've given us a call about, David.
It is exactly along those lines.
What do you think? You're very welcome to the programme, by the way. What do you think? What do you think should happen? What debate needs to be had, do you think?
Well, there needs to be a real serious debate on what we're doing with our own government, setting the conditions going forwards for our own military and security services, because as it stands, as of Labour's policy announcement, they want to take us into a defence pact, they're referring it to, as a defence pact with the EU. And the EU are offering no one in Europe a pact. The EU are busily engaged concluding their bureaucratic structure for European Defence and Security Union. So that's a process of unification of everyone's military. Now, Liam Fox and Grant Shapps challenged this last week, and it doesn't seem to have took up that much traction, apart from we've got a bit of an intervention from Sir Richard Deal, of the former head of MI6. But the rest of it, you know, we've seen nothing from Rishi Sunak challenging this as a top-down in the Tory party. And we could potentially see a situation that if Labour get in, they will simply put our military and security services on a set of railway lines, if you like, and it'll be a one-way ticket into the EU. And then we've got this factor of, well, hang on a minute, we thought we'd voted to leave the EU, and yet Labour are going to put our military and security services.
And it's not just the military, David. They say they want to renegotiate what they feel was a botched deal with the EU anyway. Yes. And yes. I think, like, we may not, you know, the rights and wrongs of the original Brexit debate, I mean, that's a long argument, yep, that has been had, and yep, I don't want to rerun the Remain Leave argument. Leave won, they won democratically, I voted Remain, my side lost, I got over it within about an hour. There are people who still aren't over it. You know, we left the EU, but that the nature of the relationship we have with our closest neighbour does need to be talked about, but being renegotiated, I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's completely correct. So you've got to take it as read, because I've been heavily involved with this with some of the people who pushed back in the referendum on it, and then again in G19, because Theresa May wanted to formally conclude this process in a section in the backstop, and there was a heavy pushback against her because of that.
Yeah.
So there was a pause under Boris. Boris merely considered going into European Defence and Security Union. We then had it accelerate under Liz Truss in that very brief period she was in number 10, where they took us into PESCO and military mobility. And the key bit is that the sort of Tories really have laid the table up, and Labour are going to conclude, and they're going to resurrect the old May deal and take us in. So what does that mean for the Leave Remain vote? Because the Leave vote, you would think, and Sunak would go, well, no, we're not doing that because we don't want anything that's that rigid.
David, I can honestly say I have heard more in the last 3 or 4 minutes from you about, yep, a fundamental proposed change, yep, to how our armed services work,
yes,
than I have in the entire election campaign from any politician. We've got to leave it there, David, but listen, thank you for your call. I really appreciate that. David clearly knows what he's talking about.
Yes, David in Exeter, if anyone knows who David in Exeter is, just put him in touch with me. We've got some ideas. Get in touch with me. It'd be quite interesting to interview him a bit further on this topic, because to me, Paul, what this is one of the things which is in the background. Keir Starmer was one of the main campaigners for Remain within the Labour Party in the aftermath, even, of the Brexit vote. And it's hardly being talked about in the election campaign, Brexit.
Starmer, in the broadest sense, I know that Peter Hitchens is urging people not to vote for reform because he wants to keep Labour out at all costs. And he's arguing for a national strategy of voting for any candidate but Labour, or the most likely candidate to beat Labour in every constituency. But I disagree with that. Well, but his analysis of the Starmer government incoming, I tend to agree with. I think they are.
That's where we started, actually.
Yeah, I do think that they are fairly hardcore, sort of institutionalist. He calls them Pavloites. I think that these are sort of Spanish Trotskyists. They are quite prepared to institutionally, if in effect, roll back Brexit. By any means possible. The administrative state in Britain has never been on board with Brexit, and it is in what I described as after Brexit, I made the argument that Britain and America went into institutional shock after Brexit and Trump went into institutional shock, and what we've had since then is what then followed was a kind of an administrative intifada, basically. Uprising.
But I mean, isn't there an inevitability to Britain having to really be part of the European Union just for trade reasons? I mean, it's very difficult in the modern world to survive as a little independent country like Britain, especially when you've got your economy collapsing as we have. We really do have in terms of having the money to spend on things like elderly care, the NHS. They're just running out of money. In fact, Labour are now talking about taking much more out off of people in inheritance tax, even people who are just trying to pass on their home to their kids. And this is an economic disaster. We have to surely be part of the EU in order to survive, or just become the 51st state of the United States.
I don't know if being part of the EU is the answer to all of that. I mean, I think Britain has many, many problems to do with its productivity, to do with its various structures, how its health system is funded, how its long-term care system is funded. All these things need thought. I don't think the EU, in fact, is not the solution to these, but nor, in fact, was leaving the EU the solution to these. These things need to be fixed, whatever happens, and they need to be fixed with hard work here in Britain. So I think the EU, to some extent, is a little bit of a red herring in many of the core arguments with regard to our economy. I don't think we should just join willy-nilly an alliance in Europe. I think what we should do is concentrate on building up our armed forces and then make the choice.
Well, there might be European armed forces, according to this chap, Andrew. Was it? No, sorry.
Well, I wouldn't hold my breath because, frankly, the European Union and European Union countries are extremely weak on defence at the moment. I mean, I don't know if Germany could mount any kind of reasonable defence from a Russian invasion at the moment.
Well, they can't mount any reasonable defence, even if the Americans blew up the Nord Stream pipeline. They didn't seem to say anything about that, whoever did.
They seem to have a shortage of shells, even.
EU leaders have signed a security deal this week with Ukraine, whether they've got a defence or not, to discuss defence and top posts. But anyway, Martin, what do you make of this idea of a kind of EU army? That's what they're saying, that the incoming Labour government might be not necessarily rejoining the EU, but doing these little deals he calls it a pact, but actually it's the European Defence and Security Union.
Well, the you can think of this in terms of a Trump victory in November, for example, because Trump has basically put on the table maybe NATO shouldn't exist, which of course didn't endear him to the CIA. And of course, I'm one of those people on the left that does believe that NATO shouldn't exist. So for me, that's okay. You know, I'm perfectly happy for him to say that. But of course, it means that American troops will have to leave Europe. We don't want them. We shouldn't be having foreign troops in our country.
Yeah.
I don't want them. And in France, of course, De Gaulle was nearly assassinated several times by NATO intelligence services, and he kicked them out.
You and Tucker Carlson are also...
Well, I know, but this is what's interesting about what's going on now, is in actual fact, over the last 20, 30 years, I'm using the internet, as people are, and I'm even having, you know, we're even having sensible debates between Hayekians and Keynesians, because in actual fact, we know each other's positions much better than we used to do. And of course, on things like war and peace, it often turns out that people on the right like you and people on the left like me have got the same views, and the centre are the ones, that the liberal centre that want to cuddle everybody and be kind to everybody are the warmongers, which is mind-boggling.
But I mean, cuddling Hayekians and Keynesians, are they going to stop the war?
If the Russians, antiwar.com and Ron Paul and all these people in the US, you know, I used to think that, you know, right wings in the US were just knuckle-dragging imperialists, and there clearly are right wingers in the US who are not in, of that ilk.
Well, they're anti-big state, you see.
Well, that's
I mean, the Cato Institute, who I know quite well, used to campaign against any kind of foreign wars, partly on the ground that they were a waste of money.
Well, that's right. It's a very good ground to grant. You know, if that's the way you have to do it in order to persuade people not to do it, that's good enough, surely.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, and of course, you know, Kucinich, when he was the most left-wing Democrat congressperson, him and Ron Paul used to get together to challenge things which were attacks on civil rights, and also, you know, they don't like a big warfare state. I want a big welfare state, but I don't want a big warfare state.
Sure.
And if I want a welfare state, we've got to get rid of the warfare state.
Sure, sure.
And I don't agree with Ron Paul about not having National Health Service, but I'm not an American.
Yeah.
But there we are. I mean, I think what's interesting is all of these things are coming to a head, and you know, we might have an independent MP for Islington in Jeremy Corbyn.
Yeah.
We might have Nigel Farage in Clacton.
Yeah.
We're obviously going to get George Galloway in Rochdale.
Yeah.
So there will be left and right mavericks within this new setup.
Well, we're hearing from some of those left-right, right-wing, particularly actually a left-wing maverick, that's Craig Murray, the former ambassador, an exclusive interview with him, who's standing for the Workers' Party of Britain in Rochdale. Is it? No, Blackburn, right, after the break. I'd just like to wind up with you, Paul McDonnell, who's standing in Jacob Rees-Mogg's seat. Yes, North East Somerset. Okay. And Hannam in this general election. Give us your prediction. How many seats do you think your party's going to get, if any?
I think it's going to be somewhere between 5 and 16.
Well, quite a few. Is that feasible under first past the post?
Well, it depends how much momentum you get and how much the Tory vote collapses. They've done a pretty good job of collapsing themselves. You should sweep up.
We may have some shy voters as well.
We'll probably have another intervention by Farage along the lines of Ukraine last Friday. Sort of thing which is actually, as the Express has proved, is winning in votes.
I'm astounded by Farage. I mean, I joined Reform Party and I became a candidate. And I would say to people, I like Nigel Farage, but since the campaign and the way he's campaigned, I've really got to admire him. I think he's a serious, substantial figure now.
What about other parties? Because we'll be discussing this next week when we sit down and look at the results. Martin, what do you think? People like Galloway, etc.
Well, the Workers' Party will probably... Galloway certainly will be elected. Yeah. They may get somebody else like Craig Murray. The Greens are obviously on a roll round here in Bristol. Yeah. They're hoping
Chris Williamson, the ex-Labour MP, standing in Derby, isn't he?
Yeah, but the problem is the Labour vote, the core Labour vote, is actually quite traditionalist. And they vote for us because they're... grandparents voted for them and all this stuff. And that's quite, you know, what you just have to remind people. I used to go knocking on doors around here for the Labour Party, and if you hear the accent, the Welsh accent.
I quite like what I call the classical socialists. You know, I like the old-fashioned Labour Party. I do think that it has moved away from, it's become more middle class in recent years. I'm not a big fan of that.
But I mean, the thing is that politics is, in fact, quite complicated.
Yes, sure.
People think, you know, it's just nice and simple. Sure. But, I mean, there's things we agree about and things we don't agree about.
Sure, Sure.
Well, I'm afraid to say it's a mess. Politics is a mess. Most people going out to put a cross, a tick or whatever in the box next Thursday will be thinking, oh, I wish there was someone. In fact, we had that, didn't we, on the debate, TV debate last night. Someone saying, is this really the best you can do?
But look, I'm not going to stand here and say there's some magic wand that I can wave the day after the election and find money that isn't there. Huge damage has been done to our economy. It is going to take time. That's why our manifesto is a manifesto for growing our economy, for creating wealth, to making sure that we can make sure all of our public services, whether that's councils or others, are properly funded, providing the services that people, you know, expect and actually, frankly,
Rishi,
deserve, which
Rishi,
is not the case at the moment.
Your family finances are going to get hammered. Your taxes are going to get whacked up. And that is the choice for you at this election. Do not surrender to their tax rises.
OK, thank you both. Just before we get to the next question, I'm going to remind everyone watching that we have got more questions coming in this prime ministerial debate. But online on the BBC live page, you'll be able to see what BBC Verify are already doing. They're already fact-checking and assessing the claims made here and will continue to do so throughout the time we are on air. Our next question is from Robert Blackstock.
Good evening, gentlemen. Mr. Sunak, I think you made a fair job of being Chancellor, but you're a pretty mediocre Prime Minister. Sir Keir, I think that your strings are being pulled by very senior members of the Labour Party. Are you two really the best we've got to be the next Prime Minister of our great country?
Thank you for being part of a small fringe party, maybe a bit bigger next week. Paul McDonnell, thanks very much for joining us.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you all very much. Thank you both very much.
Praise him, praise him, praise him, praise him.
sell out right away.
So that is I Like Everybody by the Cuban Boys. Before that, we had, right at the very beginning, it was the Choir of Guildford Cathedral with the hymn Praise My Soul, the King of Heaven. And in between, hey, it's Black Uhuru. Now, I can remember that from years ago when it was actually coming out. I loved that stuff. Black Uhuru, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. Not quite sure about dates of all of those. We are actually sitting in a cafe here in the Kumba Community Centre. Hopefully we'll have somewhere a little bit more permanent next week. But been homeless this week. It's been a little bit weird being told, no, you've got to leave, getting ready to get all our stuff out and speaking to a few organisations in the area around Stokes Croft, asking for somewhere, can we set up our studio here? And the Kumba very kindly, who are under attack by Bristol City Council, Legal Services Department, trying to hoof the people out. Lovely to see some of the people who run this place, actually genuine, very genuine community people. They're not the types that the Bristol City Council have now got to take over the carnival. What they seem to do is take these institutions like Bristol St Paul's Carnival and try to impose their own people to run them. Now, that isn't really the way. The community doesn't react very well to that. I can always remember one of the city councillors. Oh, gosh, maybe you can remind me, Martin. Anyway, she said she was the chair of Carnival, and then she became a Cleo Lake, that's right, from the Green Party. She became Lord Mayor. And she said, sometimes it feels we're being edged out of our own culture. And, you know, there are, in other words, there's people who, a bit like I was talking about the pilots with the Russians, talking about Zelensky. Somebody's in charge, but they look like they are... They look the part, they talk the right, say the right things, but they just are no good, and they're useless, and they're just actors. That's what it seems to be being. Anyway, they're very much pushing back against that here at the Coomba Community Centre, and there is some sort of ongoing legal action by the City Council here to try and get people out. The community in St. Paul's is absolutely dead against that, though. So we're, you know, almost in an appropriate place to be, isn't it? So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Big news of the week. You don't need to be a genius to work this one out, Martin, do you?
What is it?
Julian Assange?
Oh, yes.
You've forgotten about it. What do you make of it? Yeah, because the timing's interesting, and also the fact that it's a plea bargain.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I'm very pleased that he's out, because he's obviously been very, you know, he was suffering enormously. And, you know, his health was deteriorating, he's missed 14 years of his life, it's terrible. But obviously the downside is, by taking a plea bargain, which he refused to do some years ago, he's basically accepted, for the sake of his freedom, that he's given the Americans what they want, which is they've now got it on the, you know, they've now got the precedent that they can go after anybody and accuse them of under the Espionage Act of the United States of America, which, if you think about it, is absolutely outrageous. Anybody anywhere in the world can be charged with espionage against the United States of America.
No, not quite true. Jen Robinson says that isn't the case. She's his barrister. We interviewed for this program, must be nearly a year ago now.
Yeah.
She's saying that this is a very low-level court, and it's not really setting much of a precedent at all. I mean, the principle here is that the guy's a journalist. He's not working for the military and leaking stuff, is he?
No, and of course, the reason why he's been persecuted is to put the fear of God into everybody else who might think about exposing, you know, the evil that the state does. And that's why he got full support from Richard Ellman, I think it was, who leaked the Pentagon Papers. And, you know, he leaked the Pentagon Papers, he worked in the Pentagon, and he leaked the papers which showed...
Daniel Ellsberg,
that's what I'm thinking of. And, of course, it went to court in the end, and the court ruled that he was within his rights to do that. Whereas what this does is makes it more problematic for anybody to do that. And, of course, whistleblowers within the military or whatever are also under official secrets and so on. But it's journalists who take the stuff up and use it who can be persecuted. And, of course,
this is saying that the United States has tried to do this to Julian, no one is going to take any more of this nonsense. I seem to remember the smashing up with a sledgehammer of a hard drive in the basement of the Guardian,
which was
a kind of symbolic gesture by the mainstream press in London, they used to be Manchester, now London, the Guardian, Alan Rushbridge, caving in basically to the Pentagon. Anyway, we've got Jen Robinson to save the day. She's his barrister. The principle here really is that the United States and the Western world are committing these horrific war crimes the whole time, and they are the press is kind of complicit in this, Martin, but WikiLeaks wasn't.
But it was, as you said earlier, they've spent a lot of their energy over the last 14 years fighting this campaign against Julian's imprisonment. And therefore they've been, you know, the state has got what it wanted out of this. It's basically been bullying him, intimidating others. And, you know, they've got away with it. In actual fact, they're the ones who should be in court.
Interviewees on this. First of all, it's from the press conference when Julian arrived back in Australia. And then we'll be hearing from Christian Ranafson, who's now the editor of WikiLeaks.
Good evening, everyone. We are absolutely delighted to be home. It's a very emotional return home to Australia. It was a very long journey home to Australia. It started 2 days ago. Julian was released from bail in the UK early on Monday morning, UK time. We had to spend 12 hours in Stansted Airport before we boarded a flight to Bangkok. Another 8 or 9 hours in Bangkok before we flew to Saipan, where Julian entered his plea. We are absolutely delighted, after a very long and complex negotiation with the US government, that we've reached this plea deal that enabled him to come home to Australia as a free man. The agreement is that he will spend no more time in prison. The terms of the plea deal are, unfortunately, that he, in order to achieve his freedom and to leave the high security prison in Belmarsh, he had to choose to plead guilty to conspiracy to commit espionage for publishing evidence of US war crimes, human rights abuse. In order to win his freedom, Julian pleaded guilty to conspiracy to commit espionage for publishing evidence of US war crimes, human rights abuse and US wrongdoing around the world. This is journalism. This is the criminalisation of journalism. And while the plea deal does not set a judicial precedent, it's not a court decision, the prosecution itself sets a precedent that can be used against the rest of the media. It's important that journalists all around the world understand the dangerous precedent that this prosecution has set. An award-winning Australian journalist who's been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize for these publications has spent more than 5 years in a high security prison because of this extradition request from the United States. We are absolutely thrilled that Julian is now home in Australia. I can say when we landed here in Australia, I became very emotional the moment we landed, and the Prime Minister was the first person to get on the phone to speak to Julian. Julian thanked him and the team and told the Prime Minister that he had saved his life. And I don't think that's an exaggeration. I want to take this opportunity to thank the Prime Minister, Prime Minister Albanese, for his principled leadership, the statesmanship and diplomacy that he showed in leading the effort to bring Julian home to Australia. It was as opposition leader that he said enough is enough, that there was nothing to be served by Julian's ongoing incarceration. As Prime Minister, he kept his word. He raised it at the highest level at every single opportunity. He has continued to ask the US to bring this to an end, and his efforts completely changed the situation for Julian and enabled our negotiations with the US government that allowed us to reach this outcome. I also want to thank our ambassador to the US, Kevin Rudd, our former Prime Minister, whose relentless efforts in Washington, working together closely with us, with myself and my co-counsel Barry Pollock, completely changed our relationship with the US and completely changed the negotiations. Without his efforts and his adept diplomacy, we would not be in the position we are today and Julian would not be home. I also want to thank Stephen Smith, our High Commissioner in London, who worked tirelessly, and the team at DFAT, the consular staff who really facilitated our trip home and were incredibly kind to Julian along the way. This is a huge win for Australia and for Australian democracy. This is a huge win for free speech. This is a huge win for Australia that our Prime Minister stood up to our ally, the United States, and demanded the return of an Australian citizen. And that Julian came home today is the product of 14 long years of legal battles, political advocacy, and ongoing campaigning, not just by us, but by so many people in this community. A global movement was created around Julian and the need to protect free speech, and it's that global movement that has led to his release today. I really want to thank everyone who has joined us in this fight, who have supported us along the way, because without that support and the campaigning that's been done, we just wouldn't be in this position. Julian is incredibly grateful for the support that he's had from the Australian government and from the public here in Australia, and we're delighted that he's home. He's finally home.
So that's Jen Robertson speaking, or was it on Wednesday, as Julian's plane. Everyone was kind of... Were you pretty surprised to hear this news, Martin?
I was, because obviously we've been expecting that he would just end up being extradited to the US and it would probably end in a terrible sentence. So
the West and the NATO alliance has had a real problem with this, hasn't it? It's like it's almost like Julian's done a great service by being an albatross around their necks.
Well, as his father said when we spoke to him, that when, you know, the Western leaders go to talk to Putin or to Xi Jinping and they try and tell them about dissidents who are being imprisoned or whatever, they say, yeah, and what about Assange? So in other words, they, you know, it looks really bad. Therefore, they've been made to look bad.
With the war it is bad. In Gaza and Ukraine, particularly ones that our taxpayers' money is going towards, both of the genocide, the support for the Israelis and for the support for the Ukrainians, I mean, this work of Julian is more important than ever, isn't it?
Of course it is. You know, we need more and more people to recognise how badly the world is being managed and the dangers that we face.
So where WikiLeaks from here? Obviously, Julian himself is chilling out, man. I'm sure he's having a nice time just, you know, doing as his father was talking about, just playing with the kids and having lunch and stuff like that, just getting to know his two boys. He's never met before. Christian Hrannarsson is the editor of WikiLeaks. I spoke to him about this whole business earlier this week.
I'm Christian Hrannarsson, editor-in-chief of WikiLeaks. I'm delighted that Julian is finally free and was able to walk out on the tarmac in Australia to reunite with his family, to see them for the first time as a free man, Stella and the boys. I think it's an extremely important victory and a joyous moment, and I think a huge danger for journalism has been averted. Of course, there are residues that remain, because formally, of course, he was sentenced to prison time, and for the first time in United States history, a man is convicted for practicing journalism where it's seen a violation on the basis of the Espionage Act. This is something that American journalists and other journalists around the world need to address and swipe that off the slate. The first step would be, of course, to fight for a pardon of Julian by the president, for the current one or the incoming one, and also to rally for changes in the legislative system in the United States to amend something like this. So something like this will not happen in the future. As Julian did mention to the judge in Saipan, where he did enter his plea, that he thought that what he had done was firmly within the First Amendment rights, but he believed that there was a contradiction between the Espionage Act and the First Amendment. So this is a thing for others to take now, a battle for others to fight. We are, of course, very joyful that he is a free man, finally.
Yeah, so the incarceration of Julian, the persecution of Julian, is quite clearly a kind of, it's almost like an act of war, of information war, against one of the most important journalist editors in the world. I mean, we don't have to spend too long to go through some of the amazing achievements of WikiLeaks and the failures of the mainstream press. So having an important outlet, having its editor in jail, is obviously there's a lot of things we don't know that we would have known and we should know if Julian had been at his job. Can you just give us an idea of what WikiLeaks is still able to achieve? Because we've got these two horrific global conflicts going on, both, of course, fueled by the United States at the end of the day, which is in Gaza and Ukraine.
Well, I totally agree with you that the WikiLeaks ideals, the WikiLeaks model is needed now more than ever. It was needed in the past, but now we are living in a world in such a state that we need more of WikiLeaks, whether it's under the trademark of WikiLeaks, or whether others take up the banner and the sword and fight for of their journalistic existence on their own platforms, which I hope to and I would encourage. You're referring to is what will happen to Julian, what will happen to WikiLeaks. So that we'll have to give him a little time before I can sit down with him and have a discussion of how we take this into the future. He needs the time to recover. He needs the time to get his bearings. But I can assure you that that this model, important model, has not vanished. That's for sure.
What about recent revelations from WikiLeaks under your editorship? Can you just talk a little bit about some of the things that the mass media is not reporting that you are?
For the last 2 months and even up to 2 years, there has been a very quiet in publishing front for the very reason that our small team has put all our focus on the freedom battle for Julian Assange. Because of its utmost importance, because this was creating an existential threat for journalism. And if we as journalists, if we cannot fight for our existence and fight for our right to do our job, we are worthless. So that was the primary fight. But I can assure you that nothing was destroyed. And if you look into the future, nothing in the plea limits what Julian Assange can do as a free man on the front, journalistic front, if he chooses so. So that is an important thing, but we have to give him space and the rest of us, so to speak, as well, to just ponder what kind of a new reality emerges for us.
Now, people like Chelsea Manning, Edward Snowden, there must be a number of them in the system wanting to leak. Now, there will also be obviously pressure on them not to leak, not to blow the whistle. And I just wonder, have you got any advice for those in the system who want to leak material in order to get it published out there, how they can safely do that without incriminating themselves? It's rather difficult. There must be, you know, enormous amounts of surveillance and pressure on people to blow the whistle. And of course, we in the Bristol area, we've got Catherine Gunn, who blew the whistle on the Iraq war, which actually led to the United Nations refusing to endorse the war. So these are quite important people. And the attitude of the military seems to be we want to try and give as many tasks as possible to AI in order to cut human beings out of the system so they don't leak. So how should people leak if they want to leak? Is it still possible?
It is still possible, but it is becoming increasingly serious because the attempt to surveil on the inside is increasing, creating all kinds of barriers for people to securely transmit information. There are still ways and means that people can actually go to on that front, and the willingness, of course, is there. We know that. We feel that. I mentioned Catherine Gunn, who is an extremely important whistleblower, and I've been in contact with her. There are brave people out there inside the system who do see injustice, who do feel the need to blow the whistle, who do understand that the people have a right to know. But we are dealing with forces who are of the opposite opinion, who think that we shouldn't know, that we need to be kept in darkness. And so we are fighting a big fight on many fronts. It is also a discussion that needs to take place in our society, what kind of world we want to live in. So it's a big question we are dealing with, and people need to start waking up to that reality, how things are enclosing, the walls are closing in on us, and there are cameras on all those walls. This is a reality that we have to take on and start discussing in earnest and on a serious note, because it's a grave situation. You have totalitarian systems which are on the surface, but there is also a totalitarian tendency in our society within the system, and that needs to be addressed.
Practically, is it more sensible to go online and leak material, or do you think maybe taking an old-fashioned CD with the material and a memory disc and handing it to a journalist?
People need to be very wary of methods that can be taken to actually trace documents, all kinds of electronic hidden fingerprints that are put in place. They are in printers now, which has led to a disclosure of who, an IDing of whistleblowers. This is a tough world to be a whistleblower in, so to speak. But so people need to do their research and find the most secure way to secure their interest if they want to take these steps. There are ways, but people need to do a very thorough research before they do so.
Right. Well, it sounds like it's a hell of a task. I wonder whether maybe the best thing to do is just to literally walk out of the building, get in front of a camera, or go onto TikTok and just speak about what you want to blow the whistle about rather than trying, you know, to smuggle documents out. What do you think?
Well, you are then talking basically about some active resistance by the general public against the very few, and against the elite, against those who are holding power and do not want you as an ordinary citizen to interact and disturb that cozy setup. And I think that is a good idea. People need to mobilize. We have seen it in recent times that the strongest method of resistance is not liking something on social media or signing an electronic petition. It is actually the old-fashioned way of showing up in numbers, to stand shoulder to shoulder in unity and raise your voice and raise your fist. That is still, even though we might think this is a primitive manner, we still live in the era where this is the most effective way to sway power onto a more just path. So I would encourage that, so to speak. For individuals who want to go out and have their voice heard, they have a right to do that. And the more people do it, the more normal practice it is. And if you flood the system with the voices who are objecting to wrongdoing and injustice, that is another method to basically change the world. But I'm flooded with the thought at this moment that Julian's freedom, Julian's justice in the end, did not come just by political interference on the top or by lawyers negotiating. It happened because people showed that they did care. They showed up in large numbers all over the world. Very impressively, they did care. They showed up early in the morning for vigils, for demanding access to court in the proceedings, and et cetera, et cetera. That is the impressive afterthought I have that led to this important moment. So thanks to them, thanks to the people who came together in power and moved mountains.
Finally, Julian's well known for his war leaks, but what about financial leaks? These are also extremely important, it seems to me. We've got a financial system which is funneling more and more wealth to the super rich.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. That's a front that needs to be addressed, and it has been the task for WikiLeaks before, even though people have noticed it less. There has been bank leaks. There have been leaks from corporate power in the past. There have been environmental leaks, so to speak, exposing corrupt practices in that field. It has always been the question of addressing leaks from those in power to expose corrupt power. And we don't find them just on the battlefield in the ordinary sense, but we also find them on the corporate level, as well as on the political level, of course.
Okay, Christian Hranafson, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's an exclusive little interview with the guy who's now got, he's the editor of WikiLeaks now, Julian's job, Christian Hranafson. Martin, in a way, one of the key things he's saying there is how the job of whistleblowers to actually blow the whistle is more different. He's talking there about things like fingerprints now. If you're taking a document, a memory stick or something, I find the interesting implication of what he's saying is that if you take this to a journalist, that journalist isn't necessarily going to realise there's a fingerprint on there. So when someone else reads it from MI5, they will be able to find out who's done the leaking. This is becoming a bit of a dangerous world.
Well, it always was a dangerous world.
But more so because of these sort of, you know, nowadays you're not taking out sheafs of printed papers, are you?
No.
Like in the old days, you've got a memory stick, you've got whatever it is, some sort of, document or electronic document. But these electronic documents have all got signatures. This is what bothers me almost anything more than anything else about what he says, is that unless you're someone like Edward Snowden, who's getting out of the country, going to a foreign power, if you're leaking domestically, leaking information to the press, number one, who knows whether it's actually ever going to be published? And number two, it's going to have your fingerprint on it.
Well, obviously the state does whatever it can to protect its secrets. When Daniel Ellsberger, we mentioned earlier, released the Pentagon Papers, he had to go into work every day and stay behind every day for 20 minutes or so to photocopy stuff and then smuggle it out. And it took him months to get all the documents he needed to hand over to the New York Times or whatever it was. Now Snowden just walks out with a memory stick.
Yeah.
In his pocket.
I mean, in a way, it seems to me that the lessons of WikiLeaks for the military and for the government, however much they may be committing all sorts of war crimes and security services, etc., they are now almost prepared for anyone that wants to blow the whistle. There is also this aspect that I just briefly put to Christian there, which is the more AI and robots and computers you've got making decisions, the less chance there is that someone's going to have a conscience and go to the press.
Well, yes, but I mean, I think AI is being hyped. I mean, we've had Alex Craner on this show talking about AI, and I've been reading quite a lot about it recently. The people who want to sell AI are pushing it forward as this marvellous, incredible tool which is going to transform everything. Ron Unz...
Well, it can kill Russians, that's for sure.
Well, yes, but it can kill Palestinians. But they said, we've got this AI system called Daddy's Home, whereby when we find out when a Palestinian guy we want to kill is at home, so we then go and whack him with a missile. But in actual fact, the programming for that AI is the decision by the Israeli occupation forces to kill those people.
Well, I suppose the idea
in other
is
words,
that
the computer is just an excuse. They can make their own decision to do
it. Isn't it Karazanov, that guy, the Russian, was saying something like, we know you're playing computer games all the time. Maybe it was Putin was saying it. You're playing your silly war games, but we're actually serious, and at some point we're going to hit you.
Yes, and of course what they've concentrated on is electronic warfare, so they just knock out your system. You know, when you've got no lecky, you can't make any of it work. And they concentrate on boring old things like shells.
Anyway, someone else
bombs.
I spoke to this week about Julian Assange, and a longer interview I put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk tonight is Craig Murray. He's the former ambassador. So I wound up the interview by asking him both about the war in Ukraine and also about the release of Julian Assange, whose case he followed and reported on extremely diligently whilst it was going on.
There's no doubt that the West has deliberately provided Ukraine with long-range weapons and with targeting information and satellite guidance in order to assist the Ukrainians to hit Russian nuclear defences, in effect, which is the most certain way possible of provoking a nuclear war. Why anybody wants to provoke a nuclear war is rather difficult to understand, but that appears to be what they're trying to do. And the Ukraine war is not winnable. There is no way Ukraine can defeat Russia militarily without inflicting deep into Russia itself the extent of damage which would provoke a nuclear war, and we would all be dead. And we have to answer the question, is that what we want because of some principle about the inviolability of rather strange Soviet borders that cut across the traditional Russian-Ukrainian divide and the Russian-Ukrainian language divide? Do we want to die for that? Or would we rather there was a negotiated settlement in which Ukraine gives up a little bit of its land, some of its land, which is inhabited by Russian speakers who appear to wish to be part of Russia? And it seems to me that The diplomatic solution to this conflict has always been very obvious, and it was very nearly met in Turkey a couple of years ago. I was there in Turkey for those discussions, whereby the Crimea is given up. At that time, it was thought the Donbass would have some kind of special demilitarized status under UN control, and then the Ukraine is the Ukraine. The eventual resolution is not going to look much different to that, except the longer the war goes on, the worse it gets for Ukraine, as Ukraine gradually loses more and more territory. And so that solution will get gradually slightly worse. I used to be a diplomat. I know how you negotiate diplomatic solutions. And either you can have total war, in which one side is utterly defeated and destroyed and devastated and then gets everything, or you have a negotiated solution. That's the simple choice. It seems to me, as total war, which resulted in a Russian defeat, would result in nuclear annihilation, that's just not a suitable option. Total war, which results in Ukrainian defeat, is certainly possible, wouldn't necessarily result in nuclear destruction, but might well result in nuclear destruction. A negotiated settlement, it was always going to happen. And when it happens, it's not going to look that much different to what it would have looked if they made it 2 years ago. So continuing this war is utter folly.
Can I just finally ask you your thoughts about the release of Julian, though, Craig?
Yes, of course. I'm utterly delighted on a personal level. I'm utterly delighted. I was in floods of tears, and to see Julian back with Stella and with John there, it meant so much to me as an individual, because this has been so much of my life for years and years, campaigning for Julian and helping support the family and helping provide some guidance from time to time. It means everything to me. Of course, the plea deal is very unfortunate, but it was my strong advice. Everybody knows it's coerced. Everything knows it's nonsense. Everything knows you can't have justice with a country that's trying to kill or assassinate you or kidnap you. I don't think people should worry too much about this silly precedent, because it's only precedent from the lowest of courts. So although it can be used as an example, it's not binding on any other court. I'm just delighted he's home. I'm delighted he's home. And I'm certain when he recovers, his great intellect will be used to advance even further in new areas in future with his radical thought and his anti-war stance, and we will have his leadership back again. And I could not be happier.
And then maybe we'll make him Director General of the BBC.
Yeah, I'm sure if he did that, he would dismantle it totally. So that would be fun.
Craig Murray, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Yeah, so that's just part of a longer interview I did with Craig earlier this week, where he talks quite a lot about the Workers' Party, particularly stuff to do with Palestine. This is, for many people have been pulling on the government to try and get this thing sorted out finally, Martin. The timing of it, is it just, do you think the British have had any say in this? What Jen Robinson was saying, that it's Albanese in Australia that's really clinched the deal.
I think that's right, because obviously the change of government in Australia meant that the Labour government there was under pressure from its own activists to do something about it. And they had some leverage, because they've signed up to this ludicrous deal with the British and the Americans to buy ludicrously expensive nuclear submarines, which they won't even be able to, it'll be the Americans that will be basically running these submarines, and it's going to cost a fortune. And of course, Paul Keating, who used to be the Prime Minister of Australia, Labour Prime Minister of Australia, has just said this was the worst deal in history. But because they've done that nice, they've done what the Americans wanted, they're in a position to say, well, perhaps you could do something for us. Because from Albanese's point of view, in terms of internal politics in Australia, it's probably good to be Prime Minister when the boys come home.
You do wonder whether the British are just completely nowhere in this.
That's right. The British don't make any decisions. We just do as we're told.
Yeah, I mean, that seems to be the way, doesn't it? Like, Australia is a powerful country. America is a powerful country. Britain is nothing. Britain is nowhere. This was what bothers me particularly about the potential of a war with the Russians is that the idea is that Britain and other European countries are just expendable. The Americans just rub their hands and say, right, you're going to need a few more guns now, aren't you?
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, coming back to our earlier discussions about sovereignty and Brexit and so on, the decisions in this country are made in Washington and New York, and they have been since the 1940s. And that's the European Union is created by these people as well.
See, you're exaggerating.
No, I'm not.
I don't think that's even quite true now. There is a lot of, yeah, you're quite right. It's not all the decisions being made there. I mean, for example, Harold Wilson's refusal to send British troops to Vietnam, for example. That was a good example where the decision was being made here, but it may be.
Yeah, but the result of that was that he was removed.
It might be Callaghan onwards. Those troops would be heading over there.
That's right. Because he did that, don't forget Australia and New Zealand sent their boys to die in Vietnam. And they did. And they just did as they were told. Britain at that time had a bit more of a nous, and they said, we're not doing this. But, of course, the consequence was that Wilson was removed by the secret services. Answer to the Americans.
And I feel a bit guilty, really, not using the clip of Craig Murray talking about Palestine and the genocide in Gaza. He feels extremely strongly about that as a former diplomat. I asked him also about whether he saw solutions, and he's basically saying, no, I don't. Craig Murray, I think, in a way, he's a natural for George Galloway's party, but I've had somebody message me earlier this week saying, well, Galloway is actually just and the Workers' Party, led by Galloway, is like a weather vane, really. In the whole COVID business, he only came round to the more popular anti-lockdown point of view after a bit of persuading. And also, he was also apparently calling for, you know, Gaddafi has to go, Assad has to go. So do you think Galloway is a really principled guy, or is he more of a weather vane?
Well, I'm willing to listen to what George Galloway has to say, but I don't necessarily agree with all of it. And, you know, there's some positions that he takes on things that I don't agree with. But I'm not a member of the Workers' Party, so there we go. So he can say what he likes,
Maybe he's a bit more principled. Maybe he's a bit got at. But anyway, it's very difficult to know. Certainly seems like a fascinating party. And most importantly, Martin, it's been pretty much excluded from the mass media coverage of all this, hasn't it?
It has, but I don't think it'll do him that much harm in the certain...
Well, of course it does. We discussed all this last week.
Yeah.
By shutting Galloway out of a head-to-head confrontation with Starmer, this is great for your party, isn't it? It's perfect. No embarrassing questions to answer for somebody who actually has been a Labour Party member and an MP for far longer than Starmer has. He's probably an MP when Starmer was still in shorts at school.
Yes, I agree that they're trying to suppress what he has to say. But by being suppressed, you also get the right to be the real outsider. Yeah? Farage, for example, who we were talking about earlier, the press fawn over Farage. They just do.
Well, because they're right wing. They don't want it. Not really That's interested right. in Galloway because That's he's right. he's for a mixed economy.
Yes, but on the other hand, Galloway, by doing that, actually stands out. And, you know, he says what he thinks. And I just mention about Gaza before we lose this?
Yeah, okay.
Tomorrow there is, as in many weeks, there's going to be a demonstration here in Bristol, assembling at College Green at 1 p.m. This will be the last demonstration before the election next Thursday.
The BBC don't have anyone in Gaza.
Well, they're not allowed to have anybody, are they? The Israelis have seen to that.
Jeremy Bowen always looks slightly sheepish on the outside in somewhere like Rafah or somewhere looking with Gaza behind him.
Yes.
And it may be because the serious threats to any journalist with that sort of reach the BBC have mean that if there was a BBC journalist in Gaza, they would have been killed. I mean, certainly there have been, many, many journalists, I think it's around about 80 or 90 now, killed by the Israelis who've been reporting. But I can say this week we have an amazing little exclusive, which is Wafa Aludaini, who's actually a Palestinian journalist in Gaza. Now, I've been in touch with her a couple of times. In fact, we even had an interview with her a few years ago, brief one, from Gaza. I've been in touch with her since last October. But this week, thank God, I finally got her. She'd been backwards and forwards a few times, and then she's done this exclusive voice report from Gaza for this show.
Hi, this is Wafal Odaini, Palestinian journalist, reporting to you from the Gaza Strip about the latest update on the 265 days of Israeli aggression on the Gaza Strip. The entire population of the Gaza Strip are living in deep humanitarian crisis amid lack of all essentials of life, including food, water, fuel, and medicines. The Israeli ground, sea, and air bombardment is around the clock. People, especially children, are living in constant fear and insecurity, especially after striking the areas that the Israeli army designated as safe zones. As a result of these indiscriminate airstrikes that never stopped since October 7, at least 37,500 Palestinians have been massacred and 85,700 wounded. More than 10,000 Palestinians are still trapped under the rubbles of their destroyed homes, including over 5,000 children. According to the Gaza Media Office, more than 3,400 massacres against Palestinian families were bombing their homes while they were still inside, or hitting their sheltering schools or makeshift tent camps. Over 2 million people in Gaza are displaced from their homes, including more than 1 million people in UNRWA-run schools. Over 75% of the house units across the tiny enclave sustained damage from the Israeli heavy bombing. Several international organizations, including Human Rights Watch, stated that Israel is using starvation as a weapon of war against the people of Gaza. So people are facing imminent famine. Just very few kinds of vegetables like eggplant, tomatoes, and pepper are in the open markets in the south of Gaza. While in the north of Gaza, the situation is more catastrophic, as no food are allowed except flour. The Gaza health authorities have officially documented at least 36 famine-related deaths, with fatalities occurring nearly daily, exacerbated by the non-stop Israeli airstrikes and insufficient medical assistance. Around 600,000 Palestinians are still in Gaza City and the North Governorate under a complete suffocating siege. They are on the verge of famine, as no sufficient food items, no adequate water, and no fuel badly needed to run generators in hospitals, sanitation facilities, and in other vital facilities. The government media office on January 8 issued a dire warning regarding the deepening famine in northern Gaza Strip after depletion of flour, rice, and animal feed that the citizens there used to eat. The famine risk continues to threaten the lives of people, including thousands of children who suffer acute malnutrition. This is Wafal Odaini, Palestinian journalist, reporting to you from Gaza.
So that's Wafa. Well done, Wafa. Finally managed to do a report, and it's so nice that she's alive. I hadn't heard from her for several months. She briefly at the beginning in October got a couple of messages through to her and a reply, but I mean, I just assumed that she'd suffered as a result of this attack. Now, Martin, you know, it's the drone in a way in the background, isn't it, that says it all. It's like some sort of hideous evil locust hanging around waiting for you to come out of the house to bite your head off.
Yeah, I was reading some weeks ago, months ago now, that they were having, copters, you know, basically drones, but very, you know, the small drones. And these small drones were broadcasting sounds of children crying and people asking for help. And then when people came out to see who needed help, they were shooting them, because that's what they're doing. And that we've now got the starvation issue beginning to come centre stage in Gaza. And I think it's going to be a stain on the world's conscience if
the world doesn't have a conscience. The world is just busy murdering. And in the UK,
no, the Israelis are.
The world is kind of watching on the sidelines, and the institutions like the UN are really not delivering the goods, are they? In the United States, we've had this debate last night, this farcical discussion, particularly on with Biden.
What I'm going to do is fix the tax system. For example, we have 1,000 trillionaires in America eligible for what I've been able to do with the dealing with everything we have to do with. Look, if we finally beat Medicare, but we are not for late-term abortion, period, period, period.
They have a very early presidential debate, which seems guaranteed to make sure that Biden can't run as a Democratic president and Hillary Clinton can. Maybe that will be the result of all of this. But anyway, what they're saying in the States, the commentators on that debate over there, is on Ukraine and Israel, President Biden and former President Trump inflated, conflated and bloviated their way through 11 minutes of foreign policy discussion, only turning back to the topics in fleeting moments of incoherence during the rest of the time on the stage. For Trump, it was surface level attacks on how, to his mind, Biden's weakness and lack of leadership in the disgraceful Afghanistan withdrawal encouraged Putin to invade Ukraine and Hamas to attack Israel. He repeated this several times in the 90-minute debate. I mean, that sounds ridiculous, but that's what he said. Biden retorted by saying Trump openly encouraged Putin to invade in February 2022 and repeated that, if not stopped, the Russian president would rampage across Europe to re-establish the Soviet empire. Now, this is the worry, isn't it, about the US presidential debate, is the foreign policy, which the whole of the rest of the world is desperate that they get sorted out, is absolutely at the bottom of their agenda.
Yeah, well, when Obama was elected all those years ago, I remember sitting up late to watch it, and he came in and he won. And I even dared to hope that we could see some kind of leadership from the US, as we'd seen in World War II with Roosevelt, and that, you know, the things might change. But I even knew, as I thought that this was obviously not going to be the case. And of course it hasn't been. And I've lost interest in who wins US presidential elections, as have the Russians.
Meanwhile,
doesn't make any difference.
This is no cold comfort to Wafa over in Gaza. We hope to hear from in future weeks. Israeli Defense Minister has vowed to return Lebanon to the Stone Age.
Well, that's right. But of course, the problem with that, from their point of view, is I read a lot about this. Hezbollah have been systematically dismantling Israel's air defenses. That's what they've been up to all these last few
weeks. Yeah, but the Lebanese are reporting today that the balloons have been landing in South Lebanon, warning that the land belongs to the Jews.
Well, that may be so, but of course that's red rag to a Lebanese bull, isn't
it? What they really mean is Zionist, but anyway, they like to...
Yeah, well, I mean, what Hezbollah have done with what they've done already is all of these Jewish settlers, and of course all of these settlers are outside the 1948 borders. They're outside those 1948 borders, which were supposedly agreed, although they weren't agreed. And, of course, Hamas's position and Hezbollah's position is the state of Israel itself is illegitimate. That land belongs to people who used to own it, and you may have built your kibbutz on it, but it doesn't belong to you. And what was possibly going to happen as a result of this war is Israel is going to collapse. The economy in Israel is in the tank. The economy in Lebanon's in the tank as well.
Well, this seems to be game, doesn't it? That as the economy goes down, they say, well, we're going to have a war then.
That only works if you're having the war on the other side of the world. If you're having the war in your own backyard and the other side of Hezbollah...
Well, it doesn't, because the war is... Martin, what you don't seem to get is the war is on their own people.
Yes, that's true.
It's not against a foreign power.
No, it is. The Hezbollah are basically... If they go, Hezbollah do not want to fight with the Israelis. They want a peace deal in Gaza. But if there isn't a peace deal in Gaza, they're prepared to carry on fighting.
I mean,
if Israel invades Lebanon, Hezbollah are going to take the war into Israel. They're not just going to defend, they're going to go into Israel and take territory.
Haven't they done something?
And when they've taken territory, they say, well, actually, that didn't belong to you in the first place. We're going to give it back to the people who used to own it. They're in refugee camps in Syria, but they're coming back to where they used to live. And the whole
haven't
state of Israel
produce a miracle there, because they've got an absolute economic disaster, and yet since 2006 they've been getting ready to fight the Israelis and beat them.
Well, that's right, because they knew they had to. So they've been working on it. And don't forget, they've also been fighting in Syria in alliance with the Syrian Arab army and with the Russians. And, of course, the real training for war is doing it.
The hope for the Middle East, for me, comes from, actually, of all places, Los Angeles this week. This is a post by Dr. Naomi Wolf. She says, read the Bible. God gave the land of Israel to the Jewish people. So I may get crucified for this, she says, but I've started to say, most recently, terrified and trembling, to warm people in a synagogue in LA. Actually, if you read Genesis, Exodus and Deuteronomy in Hebrew, as she does, you see that God did not give Israel to the Jews and the Israelites. We as Jews, she says, are raised with the creed that God gave us the land of Israel in Genesis, and that ethnically we are the chosen people. But actually... And she says, I could not believe my eyes when I saw this. I checked my reading with major scholars and they confirmed it. Actually, God's covenant in Genesis, Exodus and Deuteronomy with the Jewish people is not about an ethnicity and not about a contract. It's about a way of behaving. Again and again in the covenant language, he never says, I will give you ethnic Israelites the land of Israel. Rather, he says something far more radical, far more subversive, far more godlike, in my view, says Naomi Wolf. He says, if you visit those imprisoned, act mercifully to the widow and the orphan, welcome the stranger in your midst, tend the sick, do justice and love mercy, and perform various other tasks, then you will be my people, and this land will be your land. So my people is not ethnic. It's transactional. We are God's people, not by birth, but by a way of behaving. That is ethical, kind, and just. And we stop being God's people when we are not ethical, kind, and just. And anyone who's ethical, kind, and just is, according to God in Genesis, God's people. And the contract to give us Israel is conditional. We can live in God's land if we are God's people in this way. Just merciful and compassionate. And it never ever says it's only your land. I think that's a great little piece she's done here. Even when passages spell out geographical boundaries as if God does such a thing, it never says this is exclusively your land. It never says I will give this land just to you. Remember, these were homeless nomads who just left slavery in Egypt and were wandering around in the desert. At most, these passages say settle here. But they do not say settle here exclusively. Indeed, again and again, it talks about welcoming Zarim, translated as strangers, but can also be translated of people, tribes, who are not you. In your midst, it blew my mind, she said. I hope it blows yours. So I'll put a link up to that on our show page, that post by Dr. Naomi Wolf, thisweek.org.uk later tonight. Now, Martin, this is the idea here, really, is that the Zionists are taking the mickey, really.
Well, yeah, I mean, you don't need to read the Bible. It's just a common sense thing. If you go to some place and you want to settle in...
Well, this is a biblical argument to use against the Zionists. It's saying, well, hang on a minute, yeah. You've just got it wrong.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's okay. And if people want to have that kind of argument...
Well,
they
do. Over there, they do all the time.
Yes,
you know,
I know.
They're brought up in these seminaries. And
yes,
these are the sorts of discussions which are clearly not properly taking place.
No, well, people are entitled to their religious beliefs, but I'm more of a kind of universal principles person, which is if one group like the Zionists are able to do this sort of thing, it destabilizes everywhere else, because everywhere else can say if they can get away with it, we can get away with it, which is why the world's got an interest in what goes on here and why the world is watching. Because, of course, there are all conflicts of this kind all over the planet. And if the Israelis are allowed to get away with what they're getting away with, they will set the whole world on fire. And also, of course, the Israeli secret services have been very involved in Islamist terrorism in our own country. Like Netanyahu.
Our own secret services.
Well, indeed. So they're all in it together.
I wonder if the European security elite are involved. Of course they are.
Yeah.
So anyway, just winding up, we're going to have our poem from Patrizia Opulenza this week, which has got a kind of election theme. And then to wind up tonight, our final piece will be about George Orwell and our little chit-chat when I went to visit Orwell's grave earlier on this week on his birthday. So today's ode is called Tangled Webs. Picture a result where George Galloway gets in. Good riddance to Labour and the cons for their sins. First past the post, perhaps it's the way, where indies from nowhere can all have a say. Political debates, too many we see, but George has been slighted, how wrong can this be? GG on Gaza stood up and keeps talking for innocent people, George G ain't for walking. Farage, on boat duty, he plays a good game, let's hope he delivers instead of just blame. A party for people, for the people who make our country move forward, putting the G in the great. Nationalise the water, utilities, banks, WEFIs, good riddance, au revoir and no thanks. Goodbye to G7, NATO and wars, the WHO, the UN, NGOs and their whores. Too long we've been pushed from pillar to post, the COVID, the jabs, to the scamdemic played host, ridiculed the people, stole money from banks, sat on fat wages while our economy tanked, sent our taxes in billions to the laundry, Ukraine, warmongers for weapons, truly insane. Ruthless all traitors, big egos on trips, so perhaps George and Farage, this evil could nip. Assange now released, another dead deal done, NDA signed, get out of there, run. That's a non-disclosure agreement, I think, isn't it, Patrizia? I hope he hasn't, well, no, signed one of those. Thank goodness he's free. The time was nigh high. Agreements, dark corners, but we'll never know why. Give Julian a new direction. Director, G, BBC, where truth be the motto, a sight, sore eyes see. Or the Pope may give pardon, Assange, with sainthood. The script's all pre-written with more evil than good. Oh, imagine the UK where we all live in peace, fair wages, fair rents and food, so all eat. Nationalise water, utilities, banks, reduce VAT so small business won't tank. Leave our children alone, keep sex from their lives, health care from all from birth till demise. MPs one job only, from politics must go, no conflicts of interest or jail sentence bestow. Put the G in Great Britain, do their best for us all, with God in each heart. On high, never fall. Thanks, Patrizia. And so I did record a little piece with some of the attendees at the 1984 symposium by George Orwell's grave. I just recommend, if you don't know, put his birthday in your diary, which is the 25th, I think I'm right. Yeah, it was Tuesday anyway this week. And there was a brilliant piece, by the way, in the Daily Express on Monday, which is not on the website. This does annoy me. It's a freelancer's writing for the Express, but the Express have decided they're not going to pay them a bit extra for the rights to put it on the internet. So it's not on the internet. So I will put it on the internet tonight. I've already scanned it in, and it's a brilliant article. The headline is Why 2024 is More Like 1984 Than We Realise. Three quarters of a century after publication of his most famous novel, George Orwell's bleak dystopian vision remains a clarion call for everything we must strive to avoid, even as its reality inches ever closer, warns Fergus Kelly. And he starts off saying, well, you know, 20 years ago, he would never have believed that anything like this happening in Britain today could possibly happen. So I'll put, like I said, I'll put that up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk tonight. And we'll end up with just this little chit-chat with the two Christians who were at, well, that's Christian is their Christian name, or their first name, rather than they are Christians. But that we had I thought was a fascinating little chat I'll play to you now, about the technology and George Orwell. And will data rapists subsume humanity? This is on Tuesday afternoon by the graveside of George Orwell on his birthday.
The technological link was not of Orwell's choosing or even his providence, really. It was the technology that was being used in surveillance. So it started off with the simplistic surveillance that permeates our society, i.e. CCTV cameras. And I was momentarily fundamentalised when I got to see a control room and the technology that was available back in the early 2000s that could ID people, and whether it was an internal database or something else, I wasn't informed, but I saw huge implications for our civil liberties, as in the erosion of them. And that's what got me thinking about where else is this happening? Who might be tracking us, for corporate or other nefarious needs, or just now we know that the data is used to see who's voting what, and you can very easily polarise, and all of this stuff's kind of been proven by academics who I tend to trust more than most mainstream places if I read enough papers that are on the same channel. So for me, it was the technology around CCTV and surveillance. Of course, now you've got the data scraping that's happening across everything, and we've now seen the latest advancement in technology, whether it's an advancement for humanity, it certainly isn't for the environment, but with massive machine models and the amount of power that's just needed to compute one search, apparently equivalent to half a charge of a smartphone, just one request from, you know, a ChatGPT type bot. So there's all kinds of stuff, I would say, wrong with how fast we are moving for no humanitarian gain. Does that make sense?
Yeah, because there's no debate about this. What's your interest in technology? You work in technology, but is there a link between what George Orwell was doing and this?
I think so. I think it's certainly a potential fixed point in time that we could say is the start of us thinking about it. Probably wasn't. He probably picked it up from somebody else as an idea and a concept. It's passed through times. You're right, I do work in it, but we met as kind of kindred spirits, and that's what landed me here. I know very little about Orwell, really, but what I have enjoyed is these discussions on a yearly basis, meeting fantastic and interesting characters and people who are just not that would fall in my normal remit. I'm terrified about what's coming, and it's what I was talking about as a child, as science fantasy, and people now just go, oh, no, it's just science fiction, that's coming, it's not here yet. And I'm going, no, it's absolutely here already, with no law, no structure, no discussion. And for me, on a day-to-day basis, I'm just taking people slowly through an education piece of empowering them to understand technology a little bit more. And it just takes a couple of cogs, and suddenly they go, I'm really scared about what's going on. And I stand there and they go, good. That's really important that you are. Go and sleep. Don't lose sleep. It's nice about it. But I want you to be questioning. I want you to be worried about letting devices into your house, tracking all these things, not being ambivalent to, oh, well, they're just, you know, who wants to know about me and my habits? It's fine. It's not about you. It's about all of us and those patterns.
So much of our life now exists in these spaces. It used to be, oh, what about in the real world? What about in the real world? And I would argue this is the real world. Your phone is just a window to how you operate in the real world. You give more information to these places than you do across a table in a cafe. So this is the real world. It's right to be a little bit concerned. You only have to go and look at what the inventor of the World Wide Web thinks about what we've created. You want to go and see what Tim Berners-Lee has written about how if we don't fix this now, there will be no safe spaces for our identity, our personal data, our secrets. If humans cannot have private or secret conversations, that's a huge hole in the humanity that we've had for pretty much ever up until the last 50 years.
Well, I mean, I'm starting to think about IT biting people, being quite vicious. Like, just think about Birmingham, for example. We've got a major city, hundreds of thousands of people, probably a million or more people in Birmingham. They've just had some sort of IT problem where they keep piling money into an IT system that's not working. The city is bankrupt. It's just bankrupt. now. There's also, of course, the famous post office scandal with Fujitsu, which is just predating on the country. So I think maybe there is a bit more awareness with stories like this that there's something. Is there, I suppose, finally like to ask you, do you think there's any possibility of getting our heads around this and fixing it before it devours us?
An interesting question, because I think if we weren't here discussing these things and talking about alternatives, which we have chosen to experiment with, for example, encrypted mesh networking and alternative places and spaces to get our education, places like EMF Camp, where there are kind of, let's say, alternative tribes of not tech utopians, but people who are able to see behind the code, inside the code, around the code. Some of these people have defected from places where the code was being made in one regard. So I think the conversations that are happening give me some kind of hope. It's getting harder and harder to turn everything off and just decide to not partake because of the integration. And we need to consider who is going to be building, in inverted air commas, smart cities, and how smart they're going to be if they're not in the human's interest to actually live there, because they're not the key people who are going to benefit from its creation.
Yeah. I'm of the opinion that all of this advancing technology, a mindset change that people can do on a day-to-day basis, is... I'm involved in a lot of conversations around AI in the workplace, and people scaremongering and worried about jobs and all these kind of things. It's not there yet, but we can see a trajectory towards that. So at the moment, use technology to augment you, to make you better. Don't use it to replace that you don't want to do. You know what I mean? Just use it to go, I want my health to be better. Monitor my health. I want life to be better around me. Turn the flipping thing off and engage with people. I want to be better at work. I want that job. Well, use it to make what you do better. Don't use it to supplement stuff you don't want to do.
Yeah, we need to. These tools are pretty powerful, and the access to information is phenomenal. And I'd be very hard pressed to take a step back from that. But whose interest is that online interaction really, and who's getting the most benefit out of it? Yes, I'm going to give you my heart rate, but you make me the best, healthiest person I can. And there'll only be a certain select few people that I will trust with my heart rate, but who knows where it's being sold. We're aware that we're being robbed. We're just getting a bit of benefit out of it.
I changed the word robbed to raped.
Oof.
Genuinely, and I think it's that kind of shock value that's important when we're having these conversations. We're not being robbed. We are being raped and pillaged at a digital level with no... It's like we're stuck as back in the Dark Ages, and a technological race has come down and is just sitting back and observing and allowing us to just destroy ourselves. It feels like that. I hope it doesn't turn into that. I'm ever optimistic, but yeah, definitely pillaged of data.
Pillaged, raped, whatever. But anyway, yeah, I mean, they're making the point, aren't they, that the rules in our society are not in any way keeping up with the intrusion of this mass technology into our lives. And, you know, we think, well, I don't care, I'm not doing anything wrong. Listen, you have no idea why what they're looking into. It could be your religion, anything to do with your views, just the fact that you are prepared to act in a certain situation where others might not. The idea is essentially to create massive profiles of everybody, and so that they can be then number crunched, etc. Whilst we were there, we got a Boeing Chinook came right over us. We even got what is the modern equivalent of the Jolly Green Giant, a massive, massive American helicopter that carries 55 soldiers. That came right over the top of us. And then to cap it all, a drone. But we still had a lovely time chit-chatting with everybody. And it was a gorgeous, gorgeous sunny day in the churchyard at Sutton Courtenay, where George Orwell, Eric Blair, is buried on his birthday. So, like I say, write the birthday down in your birthday list, and next June we'll see you there. Time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, to Jude
English, also to Paul McDonald for the Reform UK party, as well as the special interviews with Christian Hrannarsson and Craig Murray around Julian Assange. All that stuff will be up on our show page later tonight at thisweek.org.uk. Also, thanks to sound engineer Dave Bazanko, did an amazing job getting us on this nice table in the cafe in the Coomber Community Centre in Bristol, in St Paul's. So you can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send me interviews and story tips on the Not the BCFM Politics show page via there, where you'll also find a podcast, full-length interviews, story links, and you can comment too, as well as our email addresses, Martin and mine. You can subscribe to my free weekly newsletter. And if you can afford it, do donate or even set up a small monthly sub at thisweekoneword.org.uk. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Friday and 11 and 5 a.m. p.m. all week on the stream, and over Sunday breakfast at cambridgeradioqk.com. Do please make live recordings. We've been streaming from the Coomber Community Centre in Bristol live on the talkradio.org.uk stream, at radioqk.com in Camberley, Surrey, at DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, at radiosoapbox2.com radiosoapbox.com in Worthing, East Sussex, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. So you can restream us live or rebroadcast us. Let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend away from the empire of lies. If you can, that means switch off your television. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
man for living. song of victory, claiming what is yours, taking back what the devil has stolen. Hear me now. I hear the sound as the walls come falling down. The walls of Jericho, they're tumbling down in my life now. I marched around and I give a big shout, and now the walls of Jericho, they're tumbling down in my life now. I'm prophetically speaking to the barriers that are blocking the blessing that God have in store for me. Lord, give me the victory, I pray. Walls of finance, walls of disease, walls in my workplace, God help me please. I need your solution now. I see the first crack appearing, a sign that my God is working, and now I'm getting ready to receive. Lord, I believe your word. I hear this sound as the walls come falling down. The walls of Jericho, they're tumbling down in my life now. I marched around and I give a big shout, and now the walls of Jericho, they're tumbling down in my life now. My anticipation is growing with every step. I think about the peace and joy that's waiting on the other side. This shall be magnified. Walls in my family, I need to break through. Emotional stress, it's blocking my view. I'm marching around them now. I see the first crack appearing, a sign that my God is working, and now I'm getting ready to receive. Lord, I believe your word. I hear the sound as the walls come falling down. The walls of Jericho, they're tumbling down in my life now. I marched around and I give a big shout, and now the walls of Jericho, they're tumbling down in my life now. Everywhere me look, me see the pain and suffering. The people of God, them just marginalizing. But me see the sun upon the horizon, and God up on we side, so we rising up. Get up on your feet and start marching, and follow God's word and see the walls start falling. The devil's strong, but my God's stronger. He's the mighty warrior. Walls of confusion are now giving way. Deliverance and healing is coming today. By faith I believe it now. I said the walls of confusion are now giving way. Deliverance and healing is coming today, eh? By faith I believe it now. Do you? I hear this sound as the walls come falling down. The walls of Jericho, they're tumbling down in my life now. I marched around and I give a big shout, and now the walls of Jericho, they're tumbling down in my life now.